Da, da, da. Hey, everybody. The Joe Rogan Experience podcast is in need of a new way of saying that. It's fucking tired of it. God damn it.
Here are the coming distractions.
Yeah, here's some shit you should do with your money if you want to help the show. It doesn't really help us. I mean, it sort of helps us. It helps the people who pay us, so it helps us indirectly. One thing we can promise you when we have any sort of sponsorship on the show, it is 100% a product that I believe in. There's no, like, we'll never bullshit you. So anything that we have that sponsors the show, you can guarantee that what we are saying, first of all, is 100% what we believe. And if we find out that it's incorrect in any way, shape, or form, we will go back and correct it. There's the last thing I want. That's not subtle enough. It's the last thing I want is for anyone to get ripped off ever from anything that I'm associated with. So everything we sell you, whether it's the supplements from Onnit or Ting, we believe in. What is Ting? Ting is, if you go to rogan.ting.com, you will be able to get a better understanding of it, and you also save $50 on your first Ting device. They have a bunch of cool smartphones, including the Samsung Galaxy S3.
I almost
which is
bought
amazing.
It the other day.
Don't do it. Don't I know, do it. But Ting, why don't you hook Brian Redband up with a phone? I think we need his technical advice because I just love it. I'm like, me like the bigger pictures. Right. Me like going on browser.
I've been using this Nexus 7 thing here, mm-hmm. and it has the Android operating system on it.
Right.
And so now I'm like, man, I wish I could use this as a phone because I kind of want to play with
it. Is it internet? Is it on the internet?
It's Wi-Fi only, so I use my iPhone 5 to tether it to it.
Do they make any ones like that that are, by the way, it's tether, you fuck.
Tether it. Tether it.
Stop that.
Tether.
Stop it.
Wi-Fi.
It says it's wrong. Out. Do they make them that small? That actually, or is it the Note is the only one that's a little smaller than that?
Yeah,
that
yeah.
Is
the
a phone.
Note's smaller than.
They don't
that.
Make something that size that's a phone, though.
No, I don't think so. But I think
could
no,
you get
I don't
it,
think so.
Cellular Wi-Fi.
I saw somebody use one of those Notes on the other day. This girl, this little girl, had this humongous phone. It was the most it looked like the old days when people had boomboxes on
yeah.
their shoulders.
But they're cool, man. I'm telling you, I get mad phone envy, technology
yeah.
envy whenever I see that screen.
Yeah.
They don't. Sorry, Ting doesn't have that, but they have the Galaxy S3.
Yeah, that's why I want to get the S3, and I
fucking
almost bought
huge
it
too. That's like a medium ground between the Note and some of the other Google mm-hmm. smartphones. But what's great about Ting is the way they've set up their business, and the idea behind it is you can still run a good business and make money and not have to rip people off, not have to get people involved in these crazy contracts where you can't get out of it unless you pay money. I think that's disgusting. I really do. I think it's a crazy, horrible situation where when you order service, especially from some gigantic multi-billion-dollar companies, you know, when you're ordering service, when you don't want the service anymore, you should be able to say, I don't want your service anymore. Thank you very much. And boom, it goes away. It shouldn't be you have to pay them money. But that's how it is with most major providers. And Ting doesn't have it set up like that. Ting also, I misspoke when I said that your minutes go into the next month if you don't use them. It's actually better than that. They actually knock you down on your bill, and then they credit you the next month. So it's like they actually charge you less money. It's not even that they give you more minutes. They
charge you less
money.
So they take away, like you have
yeah.
credits.
Say if you have a plan and your plan is to use X amount of minutes for X amount of dollars per month. If you use less than that, they will actually bill you less.
I see.
They'll credit your next month.
Right. It's like you're overpaid almost.
It's a great company. And they use Sprint. So it's a major network backbone without the contracts and all the other craziness that goes along with using cell phone service. Right. It's really nuts. So we support Ting. They're a cool company. And if you go to rogan.ting.com, you can save $50 of one of their many badass Android devices. Really, if you're into technology, it's fucking fascinating stuff. We're also brought to you by Onnit.com. That's Onnit, makers of Alpha Brain. What are you doing, Brain? You're scaring the shit out of me. I got too much Alpha Brain in my system for your sound effects. What is Alpha Brain? It's most certainly is no miracle. Okay, it's not, if you're a really dumb person, I'm so sorry, but there's nothing it can do. But what it can do for you is what really essentially all nutrients can improve the way your body functions. It's what your body needs to run. And we live in a world where most of us don't eat enough of the proper food. We don't eat enough healthy, green, leafy vegetables. That's like one of the main ones. All sorts of different vegetables. We don't drink enough water. We take a lot of stupid shit into our bodies. So fix that first. Before you start taking any supplements, before you just, eat fucking two cheeseburgers and then go take some shroom tech and want to work out, it's not like that. You should take care of your body first. That's number one. Eat as much healthy food as possible. Give yourself some cheat days, man. Give yourself some days where you fuck off. But for the most part, try to eat healthy. You will feel better for sure. And more importantly, your mind will function better. There's essential nutrients that your mind needs to function at its optimal level. And what we have done with Alpha Brain is isolate those nutrients and give them to you in the purest, most effective form possible. There is science behind it. However, I'm way too stupid to be describing that science because I really have no education in any of these subjects. And it's really nonsense and gibberish that I've just memorized from people far more intelligent than myself. If you go to onnit.com, it'll all be explained to you. There's Alpha Brain, which is the one that I talk about so much. It's the one that I take before every comedy show. I take it before podcasts. It's most certainly has a positive effect on mental function, and I have so many of my friends addicted to it. It's some fascinating shit. But if it doesn't work for you, you get 100% of your money back. A first order of 30 pills, you don't even have to return the product. Just say, this didn't work for me. And then you get your money back. Nobody wants you to be ripped off. And if you use a code named Rogan, you will save 10% off any and all orders of all supplements that are available through Onnit, including Hemp Force Protein, the hemp-based protein, which is legal and won't test positive for marijuana. Don't sweat it. It's not what it is. It's a weird little loophole where it's very similar to the marijuana plant, but it's not psychoactive. So you can eat it and it's really healthy for you. Hemp protein is really healthy. It's what they use for fiber for clothes, like hemp clothes. But it's illegal to grow in America, but you can buy it. But you got to buy it from Canada. It's a fucking squirrely setup, folks. So we get hemp protein, the finest hemp hearts, from Canada. It's really hard to do, and it's annoying because it takes jobs away from U.S. farmers. If Onnit could, we would love to have a farm here in America and grow hemp and hire people and employ them. But we can't. We can't because we have a corrupt government, ladies and gentlemen. It's just been around for so long in this stupid, wonky, transparent bullshit form that we, for whatever reason, are stuck there. And unless people talk about it, it's going to stay that way. And this is a problem, folks. It's nonsense that hemp's illegal. It's nonsense. It's not even related to the marijuana as a psychoactive drug debate, which is also nonsense. Grown people telling you what the fuck to do. But because of that nonsense, you can't buy hemp very cheap. It's expensive stuff. Use the code name Rogan, save 10%. We also have kettlebells. We have battle ropes, all different things to get you fit in a functional way. And by the way, all this stuff is stuff that I use myself. All of it is stuff that I've learned from strength and conditioning coaches, from guys that train people for jiu-jitsu or MMA. It's all like the best exercises to really sort of for functional form, for functional strength, for strength where your whole body moves as one unit. These kettlebell exercises. You're not isolating any muscle groups really. It's like you're using your entire body. And when you do that, first of all, you feel great. It's great to have like a body that works well. It's great to be able to move things. Just forget the superficial way that you look. Just it's great. It's nice to have a functional body that like can pick things up if you need them moved. People don't think about it that way, but essentially your body is like a race car. You can choose how much horsepower to put in it. All you have to do is lift weights. If you lift weights, you get more horsepower. It's that simple, Brian. DJ Brian on the mix. Anyway, we also have BlendTech blenders coming in. They should either be in today or tomorrow. I think they're in already. They're fucking fantastic. Those are the blenders that we use on an iPhone. We just decided to start selling them. Like, they're the best blenders you can get. They're awesome. I use a Vitamix, which is equally good. Excellent, excellent blender. But most the consensus was that BlendTech's the best.
I wonder if you could blend a Vitamix with this blender.
You would have to break it up first, but I bet you could.
Let's try
it. I wonder the blades couldn't blend the blades, right?
I don't know.
They cancel each other out. What the fuck would happen?
Oh, shit.
It'd be chaos. Audible.com, folks. And also, Jesus Christ, Audible was the last one.
I love Audible.
Yeah. Audible.com. Let me pull up the URL real quick.
A lot of people are saying thank you for introducing them to the Steve Martin book, Born Standing Up.
They
loved it. Yeah, because Steve Martin reads it. And so it's like listening to like a play almost. It's great. I highly recommend it. I like Audible for like road trips. I'll put it on my iPhone and just like Bluetooth it over and listen to people talk and fall asleep while I'm driving.
Yeah, I'm a huge fan of books on tape. I used to use them a lot in road gigs. Whenever I'd have these long road gigs, it'd be painful. I'd gonna drive like 3 hours up to Maine or something like that. Back then, they were all cassettes. But I got into it, and it's like, man, it changes a boring drive into something really exciting. Okay,
sorry, that was a mistake.
These are ridiculous.
That was a mistake.
These are truly ridiculous. You look a little child.
This is what it was supposed to sound like.
That's okay.
Like a little car.
That's better. That's way better. What I was trying to say is that when you're on a long, boring ass drive or any kind of commute, plane, flight, whatever, it can literally turn something that's seemingly meaningless into an educational experience, an inspirational experience. I mean, that's the beauty of books on tape. Or it could just be like really educational. You know, I mean, it's an awesome resource that a lot of people don't take part in. And it allows you to make productive time and enjoyable time out of time that sucks, that fucking dumbass commute that you have to do every day. You know, when you listen to an excellent book on tape, man, it's a total game changer. It makes it enjoyable. You actually get home, you're like, you feel great. You're just so fired up. You know, I've sometimes gone home and, you know, taken the CD out and listened to a book on tape in my house, you know. And you can do that if you have an iPhone hook up to your car, too. I'll just continue it. I get roped in. If you go to Joe Rogan. That's the wrong fucking URL.
audible.com/something.
That didn't help at all. I think it's Joe Rogan. Man. Let's see. It's that or it's Joe.
I'm trying to look up.
Hit a bump, they say, so it's not that.
Yeah. I'm trying to look up Allison Shulia.
Okay, it's Joe. That's what it is. It's audible.com/Joe. If you do it, if you go there, you can try Audible free for 30 days and get a free audiobook. So it's an awesome resource. Audible is one of the best sites in the world when it comes to this. It's like the most prominent site in the world when it comes to, and they've been around for a long time.
And they also have Opie and Anthony shows. When you were on there, they have like back episodes of when you were on Opie and Anthony. So
cool.
Like you can listen to Ari Shaffir and us and everyone on the Opie and Anthony. They also have your CDs on here.
Yeah.
And shit like that. So it's a good way to buy your stuff.
Yeah, it's a cool service. It's a cool service. It's we like the setup. I really enjoy audiobooks and you know, of course, shows like Opie and Anthony are great to be able to get to, and comedy CDs and stuff like that. It's just a huge variety of things. But the beautiful thing is if you go to audible.com/Joe, you could try it out free for 30 days and get a free audio book, right? Isn't that what it is?
Yeah.
Something along those lines? Yes, that is exactly what it is. All right, ladies and gentlemen, let's fucking get this show rolling. This is the lamest commercials we've ever done. We need a little fire under our asses. Ladies and gentlemen, the great Alex Gray is here. We're going to get to the bottom of some shit, figure some things out.
Joe Rogan Podcast, check it out.
The Joe Rogan Experience.
Train by day, Joe Rogan Podcast by night, all day.
If there is a man that is on more dorm room walls than you, it might be Frank Frazetta. But it's only like if you count all time. You know, if you think about it, like if far as like the 70s and 80s, those poster years,
yeah,
that Frank Frazetta put in some goddamn numbers, you know. That guy he had some amazing stuff. But you, sir, are right up there. And you are, as far as like the psychedelic community goes, you're the only guy that I've ever seen that I've looked at your work and I'm like, wow, that guy actually like captured some of that. Mm-hmm. You've actually grabbed some of it, and you've for someone who hasn't experienced a really intense psychedelic breakthrough sort of a moment, I don't know if they would connect with your artwork the same way. It's beautiful, it's striking, it's amazing and unique. But it's what's amazing to me about it is that when I see your stuff, it's like you really captured something somehow or another. The unrememberable, you remembered it enough, or you channeled it enough, or whatever. But you nail stuff, man. I mean, you're that one that you were just showing, the hologram.
Oh yeah.
What is the title of that? Because it's one of my favorites.
Yeah,
it's one of my favorites.
It's the Bardo being, and then the diamond being at a. Let's see the angles here. Yeah, there's a diamond being. There's the Bardo being.
That's so intense.
And there's the jewel being.
Wow.
So see how they kind of like. It's like you have a little trans-dimensional portal in a postcard.
Wow, that's amazing. That's beautiful. Yeah. That one right there?
Yeah.
That's DMT.
Shit. Yeah, that's totally DMT.
Yeah, you nailed
Anybody who has had the tryptamine experience recognizes it. And that's what's really fascinating. Because it's impossible to actually translate that trans-dimensional realm, that interdimensional infinitude, and yet, as crude as it is, a painting that's an authentic transmission from that state will communicate to people, and it astonishes me that I meet brothers and sisters all over the world that say the same thing, that they've been there, they've seen that, they know where I'm painting from.
Have you ever had a thought in your mind or a dream where somehow or another in the dream, this has happened to me several times in my life, where an image, a really weird, bizarre, random image was recognized to me to mean something or have some significant play some significant part in my life, whether it's some friends I know, a place that I live, but it would be imagery. It was yes. really weird.
It
and
is.
Like I looked at that imagery, whatever it was, this strange geometric pattern, and it represented to me very clearly like this aspect of my life, but only in a dream form.
It's visual poetry.
And I remember so many times going, I gotta wake up and I gotta write this down, but I couldn't even write it down because the shape was constantly moving in my mind.
Yeah.
You know, it had like I was like, no, but if I could just draw this image, well that's what you did. With
exactly,
that. You drew that.
Yeah, it's kind of a compression of that. That's for you, of course.
Oh, thank you. Yeah, you nailed it, man. Whatever it is, right there, boom, the one with the stripes. Holy shit, the skulls and the stripes.
Yeah.
That's insane, man. That's as close to what a real trip feels like as is possible. And for anybody who has ever had any sort of psychedelic experience, that's the crazy thing about it at all, is that it is possible. It's hard to believe that it's possible.
Well, Joe, I wanted to give to you the fourth book in America. You'll be the fourth person to have seen this book,
whoa,
which we just got an hour ago. My wife and daughter and I saw it. It was delivered to her door, and we drove right over here.
Wow.
So this is to you. Brand new. It won't be out in the United States for another month and a half or something like that.
Wow.
But is Net of Being.
Wow, this is awesome. Thank you very much, man.
Wow, that's cool.
Wow. This is incredible. I can't wait to go through it.
Yeah.
I'm going to set it down. But I've been a fan of your work for years, man. I've got a big piece of yours hanging up in my isolation tank room. I have several of them.
You have a disco ball in that isolation tank?
No, I think that's what it needs.
Yeah.
Really take it over the edge. The Cosmic Christ, that's another one of my favorites.
Yeah.
When did you start doing this kind of art? How long have you been doing this?
Well, let's see. When I was 21, I had a kind of a crisis, I think, and I wasn't sure that I really wanted to live any longer because I was really I was really depressed. And and of course, I did not believe there was a spiritual reality at all. And even though my friends had tripped before me, I never did because I was so miserable. I just thought I'd go to hell, and who needs infinite hell? And so, anyway, at some point, I prayed to a God that I didn't really believe existed, and that if you do exist, then I need a sign, or, you know, I'm through. And so within 24 hours, I'm saying goodbye to my professor at art school. It was the last day of school, like August 30th or something. It was like May 30th. And around the corner drives this VW. And it's this gal, Allison, who invites us to her graduate. You know, it's kind of like the end of school party, and her sister's in town. And so this professor picks me up later that night, and we go to this party. And on the way, he says, "I've got in this bottle some Kahlua and LSD." And I said, you know, basically, what the fuck? And so I drank about half of it. And I got to the door, and the gal drinks the other half. And I sit on her couch for the entire journey, almost, and just sit there kind of weirdly inside myself on one of her sculptures, a couch with a soft figurine of a self-portrait. And so and when I close my eyes inside, and I've never had a trip like this since, but I was in the dark. I could see I was in the dark, but I was going toward the light because there was this curling kind of mother-of-pearl, like conch shell thing, and I was in it like a tunnel with a light coming just from around the side. And it was awesome because that was it. Of course, this was God. The light was God. And I knew that even if I was in the dark, I was going toward the light. And I saw that all the shades of gray connect both those opposites. And so I changed my name to Gray right then. And so my art has always been kind of trying to integrate the spectrum of reality into a more holistic picture of the transdimensional, the visionary, and the transcendental. Because the transcendental art traditions, you know, all the sacred arts of all the different world visionary cultures, because all religion comes from the mystical experience, and that's a visionary experience. And you see it through all the mosques or beautifully ornamentally patterned from the same visionary mindscape that a DMT user would recognize. And the same thing goes for the great Christian masterpieces. And all through world religion, there are these waves that have crystallized into these visionary experiences of angels, of demons, of all kinds of worlds. And they're really... It's the thing that connects all the world religions is sacred art, you know? And so we started thinking like, wow, there needs to be a new kind of sacred art that integrates this visionary dimension of where all cultures emanate from this vision, the true visionary cultures emanate from this. You see it in the Shipibos, you see it in the Huichole. You see it in so many of these patterns.
Isn't it a fascinating thing that art is such an integral part of religion But it's not really discussed that way. Religion is all about ideology for most people. But if you really stop and think about it, the Christian artwork, the Hindu artwork.
What do we care about? Amazing. We listen to the music or watch the dance. You know, it's the way that people connect together.
It's a fascinating aspect, though, a really underappreciated aspect, the aspect of religious art having influence. Because especially when you're stopping and you're thinking about back when people had no other transmissions, there was no broadcast images, there was no video, there was no photographs. You literally had nothing or incredibly stunning religious art, you know?
That's it. You know, there was nowhere else to go to see iconography.
It was probably the most impactful thing a person could see back
then. Absolutely.
Because there would be all this other art, but the other art, you know, whether it's a painting of a tree or whatever the fuck it is, it's not going to be Jesus, you know? And someone who can paint an incredibly detailed Jesus, and if you stop and think about the time in which these people were doing this, you know, this is an incredibly... The access to information was almost nil. So this to them must have been hugely impactful. The actual, because you could see it. And it wasn't just a thought. It wasn't just you talking about. You could actually see this painting.
They're benchmarks in the evolution of human consciousness, is what they are.
So strange that it's not really talked about as being completely connected.
Because
what about the
Mormon it's faith? The underground mycelium. A visionary culture that unites everyone. And that's what the religion of the 21st century is, I think, is just your creativity, you know, and it's your way that you connect with God, however it is. And it comes out, you can look at the arts, you can see how the arts could unite all world religions. It's transdimensional, you know, or transdenominational and transdimensional. You know, and that's what we're building at COSM.
Even Scientology has lava exploding out of a mountain and a cross with like a crazy star thing in the middle of it.
Yeah.
You know, they have their own shit too. Do Mormons have religious artwork?
Well, they have temples and they're quite extraordinary. And
so the architecture
and the stories themselves are works of art. And they are. All
the Joseph
religious
Smith story?
Yes, all the stories of all the founders and mystics come from this visionary experience they have.
I think Joseph Smith, though, it's been pretty much proven that he was a con man.
Well, he claimed to have a mystical experience,
right.
And that's what ignited the excitement, the religious fervor of people. He was also martyred, you know, and there are a lot of people who hated him.
Mm-hmm.
Obviously, he was martyred, like the Bob. Got martyred, the great Baha'i. Now there's
I'm not familiar with that story.
Oh my God. You know, it's not the Church of the Subgenius Bob. It's the founder of the Baha'i religion.
Where is that from?
Unfortunately, Iran, and I believe. And he was considered a heretic. And it was later 19th century. When he received the understanding that there is a unity of all world religions, that we should consort with people of all religions, and that religion comes in waves of revelation, and he argued for the equality of women and men, and that the friendship of all races, and so this the understanding of how. Some of the religions had failed us, but not pointing out negatives, but just positing what could be as a higher vision of world religion.
It's fascinating to me that even religions that are clearly made up, like where someone has sat out to try to create a religion, you can call that a cult or what have you, but there's ones that they've done that where even though... you know that someone invented it. It still has a positive impact on those people.
Yeah.
So it's almost like even creating a fake religion, if done the right way, imparts
I think there's
some
a problem.
Sort of
I think there's
state
a problem
of
with
consciousness.
That.
Really?
Yeah. Yeah.
Well, I definitely think there's a problem with that.
Yeah. Stuff based on falsehoods are not really religion to me. The real religion. Has to do with direct contact with God. And that's then it comes out through these stories, and the validity of any of the world religions is through the direct contact.
So, but I know people that are Mormons that have benefited tremendously from being Mormon. I mean, mm-hmm. I know some really nice, friendly people, and a lot of that is attributed to their faith, which brings them to these churches and these mm-hmm. communities. But that, you know, that thing was created by a 14-year-old boy who mm-hmm. said he found golden tablets that yes. were the lost work of Jesus. Mm-hmm. That is something that was created by bullshit, but well, it seems to be helping those people.
It might have been a dream, just like when you see picture images that are spelling out something to you. Mm-hmm. To him, as either a liar or a visionary, was you know, given this alchemical symbol. It united the symbolism of alchemy, of Christianity, and of Native Americans. Now, this is a unique synthesis.
This is what Joseph Smith did?
Yeah, Joseph. Well, iconographically, right? The chameleon, the tablets. There, you could go back to Hermes Trismegistus, the Emerald Tablets, or you could look at the tablets of the Jewish, you know, Moses tablets. You could look at, so there's a the Rosetta Stone. All of these written in stone is a very powerful symbol. Okay, so and the chameleon that doesn't burn. You know, it's an alchemical symbol.
So to us, the iconography, the icon of a written in tablet is almost like all sort of like profound ideas will come in that form, or many will come in that form, because it represents, like, almost in our DNA, it represents something of significance.
Well, those aligned with this vision, this higher vision granted an American. This was like one of the earliest religions, along with spiritualism, born in America. Now, there's a differentiation, because you have your Middle Eastern, which is mostly everything, comes out of there, and you go a little to the side and to India. And it didn't happen over here to our knowledge. Of course, the native people were wise beyond anyone, but no one was listening to them. No one took them seriously because they were all heathens, and so they were murdered. We moved to an awesome, awesome place upstate, Hudson Valley, the town of Wappinger. And the Wappinger people, 400 years ago, peopled the east side of the river all the way down to Manhattan. There were, you know, loosely federated tribes. And you knew that because you're from Jersey, the Hudson River used to be called the Mohicanituck before Henry Hudson.
Whoa.
Went. The Mohicanituck.
That's way cooler.
Oh, listen to what it means. Listen to what it means. That the great flow that goes both ways.
Ooh.
Because it's a tidal river. It's a moon river. It is pulled back and forth all the way up to Wappinger.
Why would they want to change that name? It's so beautiful.
Because Henry Hudson put his big dick in history.
Henry Hudson changed it himself?
Well,
or he got it changed?
Well, he did establish the white folk in there, and there were a few friendly exchanges between Hudson and the Wappinger. Some of the very first encounters with native people were the Wappinger. With Hudson, and he reports on it. And there was an unfortunate incident where his men had killed some, just in fear, and they kind of were forgiving for one night, and I think they all got drunk. And then like a war ensued. Over 100 years, the entire tribe was like wiped out.
Oh, my God.
And it was the genocide of a people, practically, and they fragmented this beautiful people.
It was over 100 years?
Oh, man. It was relentless. And
God.
And so the last of them were driven out, like the Scioto Trail, the Trail of Tears. Yeah. And I heard, like, later, this Native American brother came to us after we acquired this land in Wappinger because he felt it was always holy to the Wappingers. And so, you know, we put a big cairn to honor the Wappinger spirit. And he talked about what happened to the Wappinger and how they were walked out, like, through Ohio. They had to march, you know. And as they were going through Ohio, they passed right down High Street from where I was born.
You were born on High Street? That's where I'm from.
No, no, in Columbus, Ohio.
Yeah, that's where I'm from.
Yeah.
High Street.
And so I put a self-portrait, like, as one of my crazy-ass art projects, you know, really early on. I used to work for a billboard, the billboard place, and I said, please let me do this. It's a dead board anyway. You know, nobody cares. You know, it's on High Street. And it was a self-portrait, but with half my hair shaved. And so, but it was a huge billboard kind of thing, but with his head, with very ambiguous, like, what is that? And so High Street was the Trail of Tears. And at that point, Evan said that a number of the Delaware Indians began to absorb the brothers and sisters of the Wappingers so that they found a solace there. And there was something very interesting about the Delaware Indians was that they had a particular kind of haircut that was only for the warriors. In order to keep their bow out of the hair, it was cut in half. Side, you know, was shaved bald, and the other half was long.
Here's the billboard, actually.
Yeah.
That's, I'm from Worthington.
And, holy
and
crap.
High Street in Worthington.
Hey, neighbor, how you doing?
And I used to live in Clintonville and everything.
Wow.
A lot of people are from Columbus. It's funny.
Yeah.
Yeah.
So we run into so many people from Ohio.
Yeah, it's Maynard's really from Ohio, I guess, too.
Yeah, yeah, that's wild, man. So you didn't even know that when you did it?
Hell no. I had to move to Wappinger to find that out.
That's crazy. Wow. What a sad, sad story. And, you know, we spend so little time thinking about the culture of the people that lived here before us. It's so fascinating. The journey on foot.
We want to honor them and, you know, just say what remarkable and wonderful people that they were.
Could you imagine, I mean, if you have, I mean, I'm sure you have imagined because you live on this property. If you thought about what it must have been like to live there as them before the white man arrived, it must have been amazing, man. Yeah. It must have been like Avatar, except no flying dragons.
Really?
You know what I mean?
No tail sex.
About a lot of it was like, I mean, they were literally living off the land, and they knew how to do it, and
absolutely,
they were sustainable.
Yeah.
And they had great reverence for the land they lived off. I mean, they were missing a lot of inventions that Western man had, but man, I bet they were pretty fucking happy for the most part. I was in Disneyland yesterday, man. There is a disturbing trend of people getting so fat that they have to be wheeled around.
Did you see South Park last week?
No.
They did the whole thing about that, man. Fucking go crazy.
Dude, I will go crazy because it was weird. It was weird. There were injuries. There weren't injured people. They were just, or if they were fucking injured, it was from being fat. These people were enormous, mm-hmm, and they were pushing them around. There was these little scooter things taking them everywhere.
I guess the morbidly obese have not had a proper vehicle in the past, perhaps.
It's a tap-out vehicle. They give up. They just give up on life. Like, fuck it. I'm just going to scoot around. There's so many of them, man. I mean, I don't remember seeing this when I was younger. I don't remember seeing these numbers of morbidly obese people on motor scooters where they literally have stopped walking. Like, that's too painful or they're too big to walk.
What has numbed people to the point where that is an acceptable behavior? Is it the kind of crap that fast food has gone to or... what do you think?
There's certainly an issue with the human body becoming addicted to unhealthy foods. I struggle with cheeseburgers and fries. I love them. They're so delicious. But I know it's like it's super unhealthy.
Yes.
But I try to limit it, and I put really healthy food in between that. Some people don't do that. They don't. And if you don't, you can get caught up in this addiction cycle with shit food.
Yeah. Everybody who does that ought to read that old report, you know,
the
that
China
they did
study?
It. Yeah.
Yeah. That's certainly a good thing to read, but I mean, it is weird. The numbness is a good way to describe it, because it's just, you just keep eating and you don't see it. You don't freak out, you know, it's like somehow slowly but surely you just get to this insane point.
I love Walt Disney. He's an extraordinary artist, and look at the, amazing industry that's grown up around and the breakthroughs in motion picture technology and all kinds of things, that nature films, you know, they used to really deeply, and UBI Works, they finally are acknowledging his, authorship basically of Mickey Mouse and things like that. So it's, I think that they're an awesome organization that has tried to grow in a beautiful way, and in a way, a kind of the most generous representation of the cherry on top of American culture or something. At the same time, you know, you really wonder, what does it actually mean? What is the religion of Disneyism teaching us? Is it something about a passive observation of reality? And to kind of delight us with spectacles of our sort of delusional understanding of certain things? Or is it actually playing an important kind of moral role? And I think that for the most part, you know, it's been a very benign to very positive organization, I think. And as art, it's unparalleled. You know.
They do have some amazing cartoons. Stop and think about it, like The Sorcerer. What was the that first one called?
God, The Sorcerer's Fantasia. Apprentice.
The Sorcerer's Apprentice.
God.
What an amazing, amazing piece of work.
Extraordinary.
And if you really stop and think about the time in which that was released, I mean, there was nothing like it before.
Yeah.
It was so groundbreaking. It's totally. It's hard for people to really understand. Was it 1930s? Is that what that was?
1930s?
Yeah. The rides are amazing. My kids have an awesome time. I love Disneyland. That's not what I'm freaking out about humans. The fact that Disneyland is so packed, it's crazy. Many human beings in one area. It's incredible. But you know what? It's like
Mecca for Americans.
Yeah.
Anything else more Mecca-like in America?
Mall of America, maybe? But not really. No, Disneyland is the spot. Yeah. Maybe Disney World and Disneyland. Those two. Yeah. Maybe SeaWorld, but not even. No, Disneyland is like really where it's at.
Mecca.
Yeah, it's incredible. And you know what was really kind of cool about it was there's so many people there. I mean, it is insane. I never saw one person raise their voice. I didn't see one person get angry at their kids. As much as we like to talk about the negative aspects of humans, and man, lately on this podcast, it's really been a bummer. We've been having a lot of people like reporters telling us about corruption and Congress, people running for Congress that are telling us about how fucked up these new bills that are being passed are. I mean, you just over and over again, you keep hearing negative shit, and we're guilty of it too. We were discussing it. But when you go to Disneyland, you're like, all these people get along great. Like, look what's going on here.
They
people
promote
are saying,
a positive
me.
Vision
yes.
of possibility for all of us, and have always emphasized creativity as and the imagination as something that is really important.
It's amazing that they can get that many people to be friendly. You never hear about a gang fight breaking out at Disneyland.
Yeah. No, that's what kind of makes me mad, though, with all those protesters, though, in Anaheim who are trying to march towards that. I kind of don't like that. I kind of like,
well,
hey, dude, there's a lot of kids there. You know, why don't you just get away from that place?
Yeah, I think they were trying to do that because that would get the maximum amount of attention.
I get it, but don't fuck with that. You know, like if I have my kids there and you start bringing that to my kids, fuck you. You know,
well, okay, you shouldn't say fuck you, because all they're trying to do was call light to the fact that a kid was murdered by a cop.
Yeah, but you know what I mean. Like, don't bring it to hurt
fuck
more.
You to that.
Why
not...
would you bring protests where people are dressed up in military towards kids?
Well, I don't think when they first started doing it, there was no one dressed up in military. That happened right. when they arrived. So I think there's a little bit of confusion there on your part there, buddy.
No, but I think they, those people don't choose Anaheim.
Yeah, just, okay, just but some things are more important than rides, man.
Take
some
that
people,
off the table.
Some things are more important than rides.
Yeah,
and
kids.
Getting people to pay attention.
Kids are more important than everything.
Oh,
protect kids, right?
Okay, yeah, but listen, this, I don't think this is hurting the kids. I think there's only reason the only violence was being thrown at the protesters. The protesters, as far as I know, didn't or and weren't accused of doing anything violent. It was the police that were showing up with dogs.
Unfortunately,
and
if the, this
shooting
is,
rubber bullets, like we saw with Amber Lyon when she was on the podcast, they shot rubber bullets at them.
I know, but unfortunately, you know how there's going to be people, especially like homeless people, that are joining these kind of protests just to be like fuck the police. Because I saw it at
okay, Brian.
What's the shit? The thing where everyone sat outside
Occupy
the,
Wall Street.
Yeah, yeah, Occupy LA. When yeah. I went there, I was
that's
like little, there's like a bunch of drunk.
That's a little different,
crackheads.
Dude, this was a community. This particular instance in Anaheim was a community yeah. responding to a murder.
Well, it was violent. You know, they brought there was violence in Anaheim. It could there shouldn't be violence anywhere near kids. That's what I'm saying.
Okay,
you know what I mean.
I see what you're saying, but I think in this case,
what if somebody's
they
driving
weren't
home
trying to do violence. They were Disney they home. Weren't violent. The cops were violent towards them. That's the accusation,
right?
As far as I understand it, you know, and the, what we saw with that Amber Lyon.
I don't know why I just went
so
off on this protest.
I don't know why you did either. You thought about yourself being
you
a little
why?
Innocent boy.
Why? Because I was thinking about how awesome Disneyland was, and I was like,
yeah.
That when it Amber is, was on the last episode, I remember thinking that.
It is amazing. Kind of but fun. What I found fascinating about it, one of the things that made me smile when I was there was it really is amazing how well people can get along if mm-hmm. sort of if the right kind of vibes are generated. And Disneyland is like the exact right kind of vibe. The only thing that sucks is lines.
Yeah.
And in lines, everybody just kind of laughs and jokes around and kids play with each other. It's not that big a deal.
They manage lines very
yeah.
well.
Kids, some kids complain and they say, look, we're going to have a great time when we get on the ride. It's going to be fun. It's amazing how well people can get along if in that sort of environment. And yeah. people can say, well, that's unrealistic. Well, no, it's not unrealistic. It's life.
What if
Disneyland
we all tried to get along,
yeah.
you
yeah.
know, instead of think that, you know, stepping outside of a place like that, which, you know, say it one way or the other, seems a little more sacred to people.
Yeah.
And that may seem humorous in some ways, but it's,
it's
because
though.
It's focused positive.
Yeah.
It's family oriented, it's non-denominational, and can be enjoyed and you know by anyone.
Yeah, it's a positive place. It's yeah. fun. It's a fun place. But and it is sacred in that respect. It's for children. It's such an it's like a little religious experience almost.
Yeah.
It's fun. I mean, it's like you see them. They have so much fun.
You see fairies in places. Yeah. You get a taste of the visionary experience. That's what they're trying to create.
Yeah.
It's a fully dynamic, pull you into a new way of seeing reality kind of reorienting experience.
Yes, that's
you great. Know, it's like, oh, well, we just want the temples to be like this because
yeah.
they're so exciting and they're so fun. And they're some are a little too threatening, but some are, you know, depending on the age, you know.
Yeah.
And so you learn and you can grow and you can go and visit these things and enjoy them with your children. It's a wonderful thing.
Winnie the Pooh is very psychedelic. Have you been on the Winnie the Pooh ride?
No.
Oh, my
what
goodness.
The hell is that?
Winnie the Pooh is, first of all, it's fascinating because my daughter, she's only 4, and Winnie the Pooh is like you get buckled down in this thing, and it's a slow ass ride. So
yeah.
when it's over, she looks at me and she goes, why did we have seatbelts on? She was like, this is ridiculous. Like a 4-year-old is like, you don't need seatbelts for this. This is so stupid. Like, yeah. why'd they make us sit down? But you go through it, and it's all Winnie tripping. Okay, because they do it in the guise of him falling asleep.
Uh-huh,
so Winnie
right.
is sitting there, and then Winnie's ghost is doing flips
right,
like over him
right.
and flips over him. Then we enter into this next room, which is supposed to represent Winnie's dreams, and it's all neon tiggers
ooh,
knocking
yeah.
him over, and honey's everywhere.
Yeah, yeah.
And he's like, this dream's
mm-hmm.
amazing. And
mm-hmm.
he's literally in heaven.
Mm-hmm.
I mean, he's in this wonderful, psychedelic heaven
yeah.
where this like tiger who's neon colored, completely the
yeah.
whole thing is white, you know, black lights.
It happened in Dumbo, and
is this
happened-
it, Brian?
Yeah.
Look, when you go through it, when Winnie the Pooh has his psychedelic trip, like right when he goes through and he falls asleep, it's so obviously like acid based.
Yeah, yeah.
Astral or mushrooms travel. Or something.
Yeah. Whoa,
so there look at goes. This. Look, he starts tripping.
That's cool.
And then when he comes out of this dream, you know, when he comes out of this this falling asleep experience, you see the next crazy room. I mean, look at this. Winnie the Pooh is tripping his brains off. This is a DMT trip. Look at this. Look at Pink Tigger. Neon Pink Tigger. Look at this motherfucker with giant orange heads and green arms and honeys floating everywhere. What is more psychedelic than this? Look at this. What the fuck are they trying to say? This happens when you sleep? Does this happen to you when you sleep? I mean, look at this. If there's anything that's a psychedelic trip, it is goddamn Winnie the Pooh. That should be the next thing. Kids taking mushrooms and getting on the Winnie the Pooh ride. I bet you would freak the fuck out. Just a pot cookie on this thing. It's amazing.
That's great.
Isn't that amazing?
Wow.
I mean, that is clearly a psychedelic experience.
Now, so this is a walkthrough?
No.
You're strapped in.
Yeah, it's my daughter was trying it. To explain.
Awesome. Wow.
We're trying to
so
get
it's
to
a little bit like intestines or something, like you're being digested in his imagination.
Yes.
Yeah.
And then he poops you out at the end.
Yeah.
He poops you out saying, nope, psych, we're normal.
Yeah, yeah.
No more trips.
The human-animal fusion is an archetype that's tens of thousands of years old.
What do you think that is? What's the ayahuasca human animal anthropomorphic being?
Well, there they were standing up like human beings, kind of, and like your association with them was person to person in a way. But they represent the character of that creature, you know, in a more humanoid anthropomorphic talking kind of way. So that spirit, in a sense, can speak to you. Like you could be in contact with other animal spirits, but they would communicate to you in a certain language that you could understand. And so always, I think, the shamans had been able to have relations with these spirit beings. And some of the earliest cave art, actually, of male figures are so-called sorcerers, like the Sorcerer of Troyfair. And it is a horned kind of deer type being that is also a man. Clearly,
yeah,
it's got a
that.
Penis, and so it's a fusion.
Is there images of it online?
Oh yeah, yeah
Brian, sure. Can you find that?
The Sorcerer of Troy, T R O I S, and then new word,
T-R-O-I-S.
Frere, T. F R E R E S.
Did you get that? Don't guess if you didn't get
it. Of Troy Frere.
What do you think that is? So you think that these are real beings that these people are coming in contact with through psychedelic experiences?
It's possible, you know, and that. Or it's a portrait of the sorcerer that is an integration of of human and animal qualities. Now, this is an enhanced version of it. It looks very similar to that, but it's on the side of a cave. And so they would go into the caves.
The real one, Brian. That's what they did is they traced it. Mm-hmm. So you can see what it actually looks like. That's still amazing.
Isn't it? So
imagery.
So that...
How old is that?
There you go. So the archetype...
Wow, that's the real one.
Yeah.
Wow, that's amazing. That is amazing.
It tells you quite a few things. It tells you the shamanic, X-ray vision that is an ancient kind of quality of vision that sometimes you appear to be able to see through to the lifeline or to the underlayment of the fabric of the body, of the physical body, to another kind of body. But here, it's mostly the fusion of the human and animal archetype. You can see he's got a Johnson down there.
I love his eyes.
Yeah. Yeah, I know. Isn't he awesome? He's completely awesome.
Oh, he does.
Yeah, look at that.
Look
yeah.
At that
I got
swinging.
The business. I got
swinging
the business.
Backwards.
You like my tail? Hmm?
Yeah, yeah, he's like letting you know.
Yeah, right. I know.
But he's not hard, so he's not needy.
No, no, exactly.
He's
yeah.
not needy.
Yeah.
Yeah.
In fact, I can look behind.
Yeah, what a strange little penis.
Yeah, very strange.
I look at that.
What is that?
Negative.
Yeah.
Look at yeah. that sweet ditty.
Hmm.
That's a weird little penis. It looks like
Isn't
a
it?
Little mushroom.
Maybe it's
yeah,
a little
penis. Maybe it is. It's a mushroom up his ass.
Could be. Mushroom yeah. coming out of his ass. That's yeah. controlling his mind.
Wow.
Yeah, so that is, I'm sorry, how old?
Can you look at, check the date? I think it's at least 16,000.
16,000 years old.
Yeah. They, you know, the most stable civilizations, I think, were from, the earliest work of art that I know of is this amazing picture, I'm sure you've seen it, of this goddess that made out of mammoth ivory. And it looks like Dolly Parton or something. It's an amazing, you know, buxom goddess.
Mm-hmm.
And it's so archetypal. 40,000 years ago. Okay. So they were still having these figurines like the Venus of Willendorf and things like that tens of thousands of years later. Now, there isn't a civilization on Earth that was more stable than the goddess-worshipping cultures. They were agricultural. They were stable, sustainable relationships with nature.
Is it just that human beings get to a certain level of technological proficiency and then they just start to fuck each other up really easily and that's when things go awry?
Well, I think that there was a remarkable breakthrough in human consciousness that led to a cerebral kind of, you know, fire of intelligence that led people to begin to write, and to write in such a way that they could commune with the gods. The earliest books were all religious texts. You know, 6,000 years ago, you know, the Vedic hymns, the Rig Veda. And you know, that's got references to Soma, the
yes.
The most ancient of these psychedelic
better than
cultures.
Brahma, better than Indra.
Exactly.
Yeah.
And connects us with the immortality and the infinite. And
no one knows, by the way, what Soma was, correct?
Exactly.
Is that true? What
now,
is
a lot of different consensus? People have different conjectures. I have no idea. But it was clearly a kind of entheogenic sacrament that allowed people access to the realm of the divine.
One of the things that McKenna said, Terence McKenna said, that was so fascinating to me, and so when you really stop and think about the history of human culture and psychedelic usage, is how could something that was so powerful, where they talked about it with great reverence in their scripts, how could that have gone away? How could people have forgotten what that is? I mean, it's amazing.
Well, we're very distractible, and we are not certain about the kind of the game that we're in.
Mm-hmm.
Is it an ego game, or does love win the day? And can you find your own personal connection with the creative source? You know, and if your life is an opportunity for your soul to read the tea leaves of your reality and see whether it's in alignment with your heart's purpose, you know, I mean, that's one of the other great reasons that entheogens or sacraments or meditation or yoga and meditation or any of many different ways of accessing the imaginal realms. I mean, making art is that to me. And so as a spiritual practice, thank you. As a spiritual practice, I think it has much in common with prayer. If your artwork is in service of love and truth and goodness and beauty, and that would birth a new kind of sacred art, as well as these the access, the now verifiable and repeatable access to the visionary dimensions provided by entheogens. which has happened in numerous cultures, including the Greek culture. We have the foundation of Eastern civilization in the Vedic hymns mentioning a psychedelic. Then we look at the Greek tradition and the Eleusinian mysteries, also a 1,200-year-old religion and civilization. Really pretty long time, actually, for civilizations, and very profoundly important. And all the philosophers that we're familiar with, Plato and Aristotle and Socrates, would have been initiates in the Eleusinian mysteries. And so these great thinkers that form the foundation of Western civilization had all taken a psychedelic and enabled them to commune with the gods and with the ideals. That's what Socrates' whole Platonic forms, you know, that he talks about, the ideal realms that he describes, are him clearly in contact with a visionary reality. One of the most famous tales about Socrates is he walking across a square like he did every day, and he stopped. In the middle of the square, he just like started talking and arguing with this daemon, he called it, his daemon. And this was this visionary being that he communed with and had a day-long, 24-hour exchange with in the middle of the public square.
What?
Yes.
He was crazy. He was high as fuck. He was crazy.
He might have just come back from the Eleusinian mysteries.
Isn't it amazing,
my friend,
that you would arrest him today if someone did that in New
York City?
Yeah,
they would. But they knew he was frickin' Socrates.
Right, they already knew.
Give him space.
Right.
And, of course, well, you know how he wound up. You know, he was martyred.
Mm-hmm.
He, you know, they didn't want him around. You know, corruption of the youth. And so he had to drink this poison.
Didn't he have sex with a bunch of young boys? Wasn't that also part of his thing?
What was, you know, you could say, where's the verification?
Right.
And where's the notion that that wasn't a something that was mutual? And where's to say that some of the gay artists weren't the greatest in art history? Like Michelangelo, like Leonardo. Does their gayness suddenly make them bad? I don't care if they did fuck.
No, but, it certainly doesn't. But
you know, it might be an interesting sidebar about history.
Well, that's what I was getting at. Like, what was it? What was different about life back then? That was like a really common thing, that men would have sex with young boys. And even if it was a mutual thing, where it comes into question is when, obviously, when you're talking about like really young people, you can't really have a mutual sort of agreement.
You know, if you look at the ideals that Socrates spoke of,
mm-hmm.
you know, of truth and goodness and beauty and being in contact with the ideal realms. Where you commune with these, angels, and you get communication from the highest. You don't go about messing like that. That happens at the kind of perversion of, you know, what the intention of God is, I believe. But in terms of reaching, like. He was interested in what was just.
Mm-hmm.
You know, he wasn't interested in molestation.
So you feel that those are just false charges against him, or do you
How would you? You know, what we like to do is trash all of our heroes to make them as low as possible, so that you have no hope about human character. And I think that's shame.
I did not look at it that way. When I heard this and read this, I kept hearing about this in many, many civilizations. I mean, obviously the Greeks were famous for it. Yeah. The Romans were famous for it as well. And my point was merely that was sexuality viewed as a completely different thing than the way we view it today?
Probably.
Yeah, I think it's more that than a molestation thing.
Right.
I think we're very repressed, whether we believe it or not. And I'm not saying you should start having sex with young people, but we're incredibly repressed when it comes to sexuality.
I suppose.
And I wonder if back then it was just the ideal was different. The literally the way you thought of life was different. And it's, I think it's very hard for people.
I think you're right.
Yeah. I think it's very hard for people to wrap their heads around that, especially if it comes to something as controversial as sex with young people.
Of course.
It's still, you have to be objective.
Look at different, if you're an anthropological kind of fan and you really look at different world cultures, well, yes, you can see they've all got one head, two arms, two legs in general, and have two sexes, and come in a variety of colors and things. But there are many different cultural practices that work uniquely for each little niche of human civilization or culture. And it's astonishing, really.
Yeah, it's
and
really,
it's different in different times. You know, we believed this then, and then now we don't do bloodletting so much anymore. You know, I don't believe in it so much.
How fascinated are you by the Maya and Mayan culture and their? I mean, if there was ever a culture like so severely, obviously impacted by psychedelics,
yeah, it's really true.
It's like the whole culture. I went to Chichen Itza and I had a really educated guide. It was a guy who was a local professor who took us around, and you know, he talked like more openly than I've ever heard anybody talk, because I didn't even ask him. Started talking about the psychedelic drug rituals that they would have and where they would have them, and he explained.
Was it chocolate and mushrooms?
I don't know what it was.
I believe it was Teonanacatl, which was the flesh of the gods, and they mixed the chocolate and the mushrooms, which is done to this day.
It's delicious. And chocolate is so good for you, too, by the way.
I like Mayan.
Yeah.
Yeah.
If you've never had, people don't ever like raw cocoa, raw chocolate especially. It's so super high in antioxidants. Like, you know, like.
Well, psilocybin has also gotten the I think, the greatest endorsement from the scientific community.
The Johns Hopkins study?
Yes, of course. Yeah. And Rowan Griffiths, and confirming basically the same discovery from the Good Friday experiment.
Maybe you can talk some sense to my friend Brian then, because my friend Brian has done mushrooms a bunch of times and he doesn't see any transformative nature to the drug. He thinks you should just take it and go watch movies.
Well, I think the first time you take it, it definitely opens up something in your brain. It makes you look at things different, but that will always stay open. But I don't think any time I take mushrooms from now on, it might be something positive and I might gain something from it. But it only like a week or two later, I'm back to, you know, I'm not like thinking about that one trip I did 2 weeks ago and how much it's changed my life. I'm more like, all right, what's going on? You know, moving on.
Mm-hmm.
You know, like it's never.
You haven't properly integrated it then, my friend, because an actually dousing of one's consciousness into the infinite is well worth considering about how it relates to your everyday reality and what does it say. You know, what is the nature of consciousness? Who are you ultimately, and what does God want of you? Basically,
yeah.
And I believe that your entire life is basically an expression of that. Mm-hmm. You know, it's a natural thing. That's why we call art our religion, or creativity in any form is this sacred thing. And because it's an expression of ourself, this unique lens through which the creative spirit passes.
Mm. Not him.
Nah.
It's Wizard of Oz on mushrooms with Pink Floyd synced up.
Yeah, it's not like that. But
that's the cartoon level, man. That is like, I mean, if you have any interest in this, don't trip again until you read Stan Grof's work.
He's not reading shit.
Mm-hmm. Well, you see, if you want to get the most out of an experience like that, a real opportunity to drop into infinite love, where you and God become one, you know, you meet your own God self, it is possible. But in Roland Griffith's study, it was those who actually were interested in contact with spiritual reality who had an intention about it. Spiritually inclined people were the ones who were opened up 65% of the time. Now, each of them thought it was a positive experience. Not all of them you know, got all the way to the mystical experience. But the mystical experience is something pretty well defined. And once a person actually has that experience, it's affirmative. It's so affirmative that you reorient your life to relate to it. And it may not change your outer appearance of your life, but it may empower it in some way with hope and, you know, new kind of creative dreams that, you know, where's your creative flow coming from? It's not just cash flow. It's got to be, you know, connected with whatever you feel like your creative spirit is. I have no problem with the word God, but a lot of people have trouble with that. But I think that it's a legitimate way of thinking of your relationship with a spiritual reality.
Just to play devil's advocate, and yeah. Only so that we could answer the question, when you talk about these people that wanted to have this experience and then had the 65% yeah. of them, yeah. I mean, how much of what we're talking about is real? And when you go into it with good intentions to have some sort of a visionary experience, how much of it is your imagination? How much of it is your imagination acting with a hallucinogenic drug to produce this euphoric state that you think is visionary contact or some sort of spiritual contact? And how much of it could just be your imagination mixed with drugs? And this is what you were looking for, so your imagination created it for you. And I'm not saying that that is bad or good, because I have a feeling as I get older, this makes more and more sense, even though it's harder and harder to talk about. I have a feeling that things are neither real nor not real. I have a feeling that the way we try to define things in such simple terms, I don't necessarily think that the imagination is not real. I think the imagination has some sort of weird impact. The
it
mind and intention
does.
And the creativity has some sort of a weird impact on reality.
Of course.
So
that is the evolutionary edge of reality. The creative spirit is evolution in action.
Is that weirdly defined when you use the word God?
Weirdly defined?
Yeah.
That's God's paintbrush,
mm-hmm.
You know? Who created all this? But, not you or me, you know? How much of all of the spectacle of reality did we really have a part in creating?
Right,
you know?
But when you say it, when you're saying God, I completely agree with you that that is the most beautiful way to describe God, and probably the most, if there is some sort of an overwhelming power to this,
the
this
creative force,
whatever
they're
it
all,
is.
They all yeah. describe the sacred reality as a creative force.
Yes.
And it at the first moment, you know, mm-hmm. and it's the declaration, let there be light,
yes.
let there be, you know, it's the positive affirmation of the creation.
Mm-hmm.
You know, like, what is it, 13.7 billion years ago, there was an affirmation that took place, and we're the living result of it. The mm-hmm. evolutionary wave has brought us to this moment, and it's an awesome, awesome thing if you really look at it, you know.
Yeah.
You know, 4 billion years of evolution on Earth, practically, and it, from blue-green algae to human beings gibbering at each other on a radio mm-hmm. podcast. Holy fuck.
And we are to the future, just like amoebas are to us.
Absolutely.
No question about it.
Tiny.
My question was, when I said, does it weirdly define it, to use the word God? Because the word God, to a lot of people, does not mean that. To a lot of people, and probably most of the world, the word God means a deity who created the earth and did it with certain intentions and has rules that you have to follow, or there will be repercussions. It's a completely different kind of God than what you're describing.
Well, if one would give themselves the pleasure of being introduced to the various faces of God, you know, that to expand their minds beyond any dogma,
mm-hmm.
don't really submit to the authority of any religious dogma
right.
until you've examined reality, and it has to jibe with science. You know, we have awesome tools now for actually analyzing reality.
Yeah, we can measure shit.
Yeah.
Yeah.
So don't leave that out or discount it or anything like that.
Yeah.
And so it has to have a sense of justice, all the rest of the things that religion has always had. And that's why if we enacted our creative spirits in the service of love,
mm-hmm.
And that's what happens at Disneyland. You see that there's a lot of love in families. To come what may, and they yell at each other, and they don't get along, and they're bitter and whatnot. But maybe for a few hours, they can suspend themselves and just delight in being together, having a visionary experience. It's a kind of a drop-down visionary experience that takes you outside of yourself. You get pulled in. You lose your ego for a moment and join in a collective imaginal experience.
And by the way, ladies and gentlemen, if you're playing the Joe Rogan Experience drinking game and you drink every time someone says the word experience today, you're dead. You're not going to make it. Don't play this game.
Shots.
Stop it. Don't play this game. My just point was that the word God has already, it's like so, to so many people. I absolutely agree that what your
definition, our concept of God must evolve. Okay, it can't be stuck in a fundamentalist definition. Just like our definition of religion, as Bob Jesse, my dear friend, who counsel on spiritual practices, he said, Alex, you know, there's a primary religious experience, and then there's everything else, you know. And so the primary religious experience was this contact with the divine, and that was at the heart, the mystic. Every one of these world, we said Eastern and Western civilization started with psychedelic reality. Okay, then look through all the major world religions. They all started with this visionary experience. You know, Moses sees a burning bush. Would the guy next to him have seen it burning? I don't think so. It was his neurons that were burning. He was ignited with this voice of God and with this experience of this fire, not unlike Joseph Smith's fire, a fire which is a visionary fire.
Do you know that Jerusalem scholars have recently started attributing that to a psychedelic experience?
Moses. Yes! Yeah.
Well,
awesome!
Apparently, there's actually science behind it, apparently.
Yeah!
The acacia tree
is
a very
DMT.
High content of DMT. Yeah, and that bush, the acacia bush, it's very common in that area. The burning bush, he talks to God. He finds out how men should
live
together.
Holy shit, the DMT trip was the foundation of this Jewish
completely makes
Messiah.
Sense. Nothing has...
Well, what was the manna growing out there, man?
It's a good question.
Was that the growing on the sacred calf that they were worshiping? Because, hey, man, we eat the stuff that grows out of their poop, you know?
Yep. I mean, no question that was not that just that cows were worshipped because of that. They were they didn't eat them because they were worshipping them because they created these mushrooms that would let them communicate with God.
Exactly.
There can be no clearer, when you're talking about poor people in India, there could be no clearer example of an entheogen being a connection to God than you literally don't kill these animals that you could use for food.
Yes.
You literally starve.
But you do milk them.
Yes.
And it's of interdependent kind of symbiotic positivity,
mm-hmm.
you know, for each one. And there's a friendship
Not
that develops between the creature world and the human world. This sense of camaraderie with the creature world, but in her case, the actual creature in Disneyland. We don't experience these creatures all the time. We live in the cities. We forget about our connection with the creatures. And so a trip to Disneyland may remind you, even if in a anthropomized way. But they have really been working on that, too. They'll go down and open a zoo element and try to care for animals because they're part of the human story. The animals are branches on the evolutionary tree that we're in relationship with in this mighty evolutionary patchwork that is the mycelium of consciousness on the earth that runs through everybody.
It is pretty fascinating that we have, I mean, humans, for the most part, think of animals. You think of your dog, your cat, and then some shit that's in a cage somewhere that you can go stare at, or something that you can watch on a DVD. But it really is fascinating when you stop and think about the vast majority of animals on this planet are not us. Like, this is not our planet.
No.
We are on this thing. We've just figured out how to build these really stunning structures that keep them out for the most part. But even that, like, they've been spotting coyotes in Manhattan lately. Mm-hmm. They've had several coyote spottings in Manhattan.
Wonderful.
There was a
Those are the shamans.
Coyotes are?
Yes.
They're cat eaters. That's what they are.
Yeah. And rat eaters, maybe, and
That's
stuff.
That's true, too.
They're coming in for help, you know. And it's interesting to see who thrives and who declines in the animal populations in these really difficult times, I'm afraid, we're going through, mostly caused by humans. And
as far as like the polluting of the
Earth, of course, and the heating up of the atmosphere and the political suicide and you know, it's like, I feel like it's the mighty mission of art to try and uplift humanity beyond its self-destruction. Mm-hmm. You know, this is why all creators need to really consider the ethical stand that they're taking in their culture. And not just be like soldiers of fortune. If you're selling your soul that cheaply, you know, if you're not taking people to some kind of creative source and positive force that is at the heart of their own creative spirit, if you're not trying to ignite and uplift people's souls, what are you doing? Why are you doing it?
What about people that would just try to be entertaining? Is that uplifting someone's soul? I mean,
maybe.
If someone just
it might be. Is it always at the expense of someone? Are we always making fun of people? Is that the highest that we can reach for in terms of our? I mean, it doesn't hurt to disarm our kind of pompousness, you know, to try and knock down everybody. I think that there's positivity in that, you know, so that we're, you know, less. You know, pompous.
Some of my favorite humor is people getting shit on.
Yeah, of course. So do I. And we love the drama.
Like Kinison and
he's amazing.
And my friend Joey Diaz would just yell at people for serving them ranch dressing. It's very negative, but it's hilarious.
It stirs things up. Well, you know, we saw.
But it's fiction. It's like watching a movie with fake violence in it. You know, it's like watching people get killed by werewolves. You know, it doesn't really freak me out because there's no werewolves and it's not real. I enjoy it. It's fun. It's just a silly, created piece of art. It's a ride, you know, and it is, you know, it's obviously at somebody's expense. That guy who fucked up and went in the basement, that guy gets it, you know? But I still enjoy it.
What does it feed in them?
What does it feed in comedy?
What does it feed in the human soul?
Well, it gives the human soul an escape for a short amount of time and gets them to think about how ridiculous something that someone just said, even if it's really negative, how preposterous and ridiculous it is, especially done in the form of stand-up comedy. And for me, I just enjoy it as an art form. I enjoy offensive comedy as an art form. Like, I enjoy Andrew Dice Clay. I think he's hilarious. I treat him like I treat a band that I enjoy. I like what they're doing. I like what they're doing. It's fun for me.
Well,
it's a work of art. It's certainly not, if I wanted to talk to him as a human being, and that was what his point of view on life represented. No, he's saying a bunch of shit that is really silly, and he's doing it to, you know, in this character because he knows it's funny. He knows what he's doing. He knows how to make you laugh. And there's a big difference between that and it representing his life philosophy, representing who he is as a person. Mm-hmm. It's art.
We need stand-up philosophers.
Yeah, we do and we don't. We also just need comedy. You know?
You're right.
There's plenty of philosophizing going on in this podcast.
Yeah.
You know, if I applied this amount of philosophy to my stand-up, I'd fucking be...
No one
would show up. People would go to sleep.
I hear you.
After a while, they'd be like... To command someone's attention for an hour and 10 minutes, you have to be funny.
Yeah.
And you have to work on being funny. And it's like, you can't have... There's a certain amount of philosophy that people will accept, and certain amount that if you're trying to get a point across, you have to throw in.
Yeah.
You know, you really have to explain people where you're coming from. But the beautiful thing about the podcast is when I was younger, I always thought that like one day I would have like a message, like as a comic, you know, like my comedy was so juvenile and ridiculous. And a lot of it is about sex and stupid shit. And I was like, well, someday I'll evolve my comedy to the point where it's like, it's got like a message, because I admired certain comics that had that. Hmm. But then as I got older, and especially as I started doing the podcast, that became less and less interesting to me. Like, I don't want to hear your point of view through stand-up. It's just the same way I don't want to hear a complex idea described through a song. Mm-hmm. I want you to tell me what you're really thinking, and explain to me over with all the words possible in the most descriptive and intricate and objective and subjective way possible. I want you to explain it to me with your own words. Yeah. You do that just through stand-up. It's a limited medium. It's not what it's for. It's for cracking jokes.
Yeah.
It's for making people laugh. Yeah, right. And if it's at someone's expense, the way I feel like, it's tough shit. Yeah. You should be able to take the hit.
Because
if
you're not looking at life about this instead of feeling so serious about it.
Not only that, I don't think it's good to enforce the idea that people should be so fucking sensitive when it comes to people communicating about them.
Yeah.
I think there's far too many people that get butthurt too easy in this country, in this world, in this universe. I think we have to be able to make fun of things, and you have to be able to laugh at your own self.
Right.
When you say, oh, is it someone else's expense? Sometimes they need that shit. Mm-hmm. Some people are ridiculous.
Right.
And some people look for every fucking opportunity to cry or be negative or whine about shit or do something stupid. And those people, I think it's culturally, it's important to knock them down. It's important. It's important to all laugh together. Yeah. It's important for them, because if they're doing ridiculous behavior and you highlight that ridiculous behavior, it benefits them, because now they get a chance to see that, oh, everybody thinks I'm a fucking dummy.
That's part of how we evolve consciousness, by becoming conscious of something that appears to be a wrongdoing.
And if they can't accept that, all they're doing is dragging their heels behind the evolution train. That's all they're doing. They're kicking at the dirt, trying to slow down the train. They don't want to evolve themselves. So they don't want to have anything. Because if you're making fun of them unjustly, guess what? It won't be funny. If there's no word, there's no truth to your words.
It won't spontaneously make people laugh, because you've spoken a truth that no one will say, and it scares the crap out of people. You know, like when Bill Hicks would let loose on things, you know, it was like, oh my God, can he say that? He said that.
Yes,
you know, and every time he would say something, you know, it was, oh my God, I didn't know I was going there and there.
Yeah.
And it was a genius, you know, of carving territory. But he also, even if he painted hell, he painted a little bit of heaven too. And I love that about him.
Yeah, he really did. He had some great points that weren't necessarily even funny, but he wanted to make them when he, you know, when he was doing certain bits. But he was so interesting that he carried it anyway. You know, he had this like thing that he wrote down, the Bill Hicks rules for stand-up or something like that. I forget what it was. But one of them was, I'm paraphrasing it, that you didn't always have to be funny, just be interesting. Like, there's sometimes you use the funny, you get the funny in there, and then you could tell them something that is entertaining for a brief moment, just not necessarily funny. You know, it's a tricky thing to do in stand-up, especially, and not be preachy. That's where shit gets weird.
Yeah.
Like, it's annoying for people. They go see a comedian and they get really preachy.
Yeah, I hear that.
Because it's the intoxicant of the stage, you know, you're allowing people to have a massive amount of control over the influence that they have on you.
Yeah.
To stand up on top with a big spotlight on you and an echoey voice and, you know, magnified voice, all of that is ridiculous. So because you're in this situation, there comes a time where a lot of people do things just because they want people to think they're smart. They do things just because this is going to get a big impact. And then they got to start getting really preachy, and that's what it is. It becomes disingenuous. You lose this connection with the comic.
Well, I saw Lily Tomlin do something extraordinary, you know, like Signs of Intelligent Life on Earth or something like that.
I heard that was very good.
And even though it came out of love and self-reflection, and that kind of thing is really rare. And I'm doing is saying, all of culture is necessary, and the freedom of expression is guaranteed, absolute. I think and it's the only way that the creative spirit can feel free enough to do anything, and to explore and evolve into territory. But if you're going to then call it something like sacred art, or if you're going to try and reintroduce, because my wife and I had these mystical experiences, and what are you going to do then? Oh, I think I'm just going to make art about the marketplace because that's the only thing that's going these days, you know, or maybe I should do some kind of vulgar, transgressive thing to really make a spectacle and things, or maybe I should critique corporate, you know, vacuity or something like that. No, the mystical experience, that's the most important thing. And throughout history, see, the reason that Bob Jesse said, don't give the fundamentalist the word religion, it's, you know, then okay, you can't evolve that concept. It's too important a concept to let go of. And so you have to evolve it. You have to take it on and say, okay, there was a primary religious experience, that was the mystical experience, that was the visionary experience that contacted, such as the Moses moment or these various kinds of things. Those things recur and they continue. And so there is contact with a sacred reality. And if we look at love, just people still believe in love and they feel it from their kids and things. Now that means love is a cosmic force. God or creator, whatever name you want to say, or just the Big Bang brought us. And in a, if anybody looks at the amount of intelligence that it goes to create a cell, you know, Dr. Hoffman, Albert Hoffman, the discoverer of LSD, used to talk about, do you think it would be possible for the parts of a cathedral to be laid out on a football field and to assemble themselves into a cathedral? Now, you think of the unlikelihood of that, even given the, you know, like an infinite time, and you know that it takes intelligence to build a cathedral. And he said a self-reproducing cell is much more difficult to construct than a cathedral. And it is done in such a microscopic way that you have to. A good scientist would simply infer that the intelligence that constructed the universe is at work in so many systems that we see around us. And you would, even if you part of your small mind is absorbed with the daily bullshit that comes floating by your screen, and you get upset about it, and you get hooked into your emotions and all that stuff. On the background reality, if you could just lean away from the bullshit and tap into the infinite that is always there, the divine creative spirit that really turns people on. That's the thing that people want to experience, the ecstasy of creation. You know, and when you're even gardening, or when you're cooking a new kind of soup, or you're being creative, you're happier. You're not thinking about the thing that she said to you, or the thing that he did, or the, how terrible the world is, or anything like that. You've transcended the chatter of the mind, briefly, and entered a creative flow that is an intuitive flow. That is just a plane of consciousness higher than the, most of the current video screens that people are tapped into. So if you could just begin to lean away from that mental stuff and back into the creation that brought us here, then you'd see, like, wow, okay, things aren't really so fucked up, actually. You know, okay, so we blow it. Look at the magnificence of this intelligent evolution to a point where we have, even though we don't know what reality is, and this part of the imagination and consciousness, these are great mysteries. That's, you know, we are God speaking to God. We're consciousness speaking to consciousness. Is the way that I see you. You're tapped into so many networks. You're part of a wider intelligence that encircles the globe and that listens avidly for your independent advocacy for points of view that are very marginalized in society. It's an extremely important stand to take as a cultural hero to many, that you will acknowledge certain things that are not popular, but you feel it's important to say. So your work comes from a place of the heart and a place of justice and a place of kind of righteous understanding of the multiple dimensions that we all dwell within.
Well, it also, my point of view comes from a person that feels that, like, how I know myself and my tendencies to get in bad patterns in my own life and how I've overcome that and how I've sort of molded my mind and changed the way I thought about yes. just reality, my interactions yeah. with human beings, all yeah. these things. I know that I'm not unique in my ability to do that. I know that a lot of people have done that, right. can do that, and are doing that. And one of the things yeah. that's been the most positive benefit of this podcast, for sure, is running into so many people that have said that listening to these conversations and taking in these different points of view, these well-considered points of view, have actually benefited their lives, changed their lives. People are eating healthy
food. Isn't that awesome?
People are exercising. Yeah, it's amazing.
It's direct transformation. Yoga. It's the, I guess, the fourth quadrant of how art and a podcast is a work of art.
Yeah.
It's not only visually beautiful, but, you know, Brian's been weaving in the sound effects, and it's a work of art.
That's not art. Don't tell him that's art.
Okay, okay.
Jesus but Christ, what are you doing?
I don't want to inflate anyone, but I'm saying...
Next hour will just be bing, meow.
Yeah, yeah. Whoa, whoa. None of that.
Don't yeah. encourage him. Oh, you son of a bitch. There it goes.
It's got the shaman's rattle.
That is the shaman's rattle, right? Is it shaman or shaman?
I've used both at varying times.
Yeah.
Some say shaman.
Yeah,
some
it's a tricky one. It's like Bahrain, right?
Yeah.
Bahrain.
it's cool.
So you're this gentleman who you quoted about the word religion, don't give it up to the fundamentalists.
Yeah.
You feel the same way about the word God. It's
yeah,
like, don't give
exactly.
it to people that have a narrow definition of it.
Keep
just
expanding
use it,
it.
Use it even though there is a standard definition that a lot of people sort of think, oh, you're religious. Are you a Christian, sir? Do you believe Jesus is your savior? And then things get strange.
Well, you that,
know,
you know,
ideology.
That, yeah, the ideology can ensmall in us.
Yeah. And it absolutely does.
And so the real religion, the primary religious experience, is direct contact of self with God. Now, that is still valid and important.
And then the ability to let go and reach these strange realms of higher consciousness that are available with and without help from any sort of entheogens.
Absolutely. Prayer and meditation
sure.
alone as the royal road, you know.
The mind is very variable. It's very variable in its frequencies. It's very variable in where you can take it. And my own experiments with, I shouldn't say experience, part of my life is isolation tanks. It's
yes.
a huge part of my development as a human.
That's a fabulous kind of late 20th century addition to spiritual practices.
And
that
unfortunately,
John
overlooked.
Lilly really founded. And he was one of the psychedelic fathers of this. I see.
By the way, I should say something about Lilly
yeah,
that just
yeah.
came out today. They're showing on Twitter, it's going crazy. Ketamine used
yes.
to cure depression.
Wow.
I mean, they're saying that it's one of the most effective uses of cures for depression they've
wow.
ever found.
Really?
Yeah. Ketamine
from repeated or simply one dose?
Well, one dose has an impact. The same thing
oh,
they were saying
that's
about psilocybin.
Sure.
But,
yeah.
you know, I don't know exactly
wow.
which what they're claiming
well,
is.
Well, yeah, vitamin
but
K.
But Lilly was a fabulous proponent of ketamine.
Oh, my God. Well, you know, ketamine has an interesting kind of shadow side, too.
Yes.
That I've seen.
It's very addictive.
Yeah, for people. And I never saw that in the classic hallucinogens that were psilocybin or even LSD or DMT. They're not really addictive in
right.
the kind of strict sense. So ketamine is one of those interesting new substances. It was extensively studied in the 60s in the Vietnam War and used actually as a battlefield medicament. And then small amounts of it snorted or smoked and various things like that take people into these dimensional... it's kind of like a catapult for your consciousness. It goes flinging out if you're laying down into... what seems like a very rapid motion of your consciousness going very fast, even though you're laying down, and over a texture, a kind of a vast texture. And we had these kind of openings into the void that were very profound and very heart-opening in a way.
It is a horrible club drug, though. It should be used very sparingly,
yes.
And it should be treated with great respect.
I never heard. I had a number of friends. I never got into it, frankly.
Yeah.
You know, we were injected with it, I think, a couple of times, like back in the 70s, and it was it was an available thing, and a psychiatrist gave us that experience. And it was profound.
My friend Todd McCormick, do you know Todd? Marijuana activist, very interesting guy. He got injected by John Lilly himself with ketamine in Lilly's isolation tank.
Whoa!
Yeah, and he went deep, and he was kind of freaking out in the tank.
Yeah.
So Lilly shoots ketamine into himself, gets in another tank, and goes and visits him. Whoa!
Yeah. Well, that is high tech shamanism.
Yes.
That is high tech shamanism.
Oh, yeah.
That hey, I ventured into the coincidence control here that I'm not familiar with, and I'm really freaking out. And so, I mean, he might have even had to, pay a little something to his buddies who run the machines to get his friend back.
Pay a piece of your consciousness? What do you have to give up?
Oh, no, it was just like, hey, I'll give you my sex.
I'll give you my sex?
Yeah.
Those.
I'll change from male to female.
Really?
John Lilly?
He changed from male to female?
I believe he did.
Whoa. So you're saying that my friend Todd McCormick and his irresponsible use of ketamine
forced John Lilly to become a female?
I think that's what you just said.
Well, I don't mean it. I'm just fantasizing.
Is that
like?
Did he do that though? Did he change?
He did
sex?
Do that. I don't think it had anything to do with your friend at all.
Okay.
It was for him, I'm sure, a creative evolutionary step.
So ketamine essentially
he marched toward the divine feminine and embraced it.
That's interesting. Well, a lot of people believe that is the number one problem with the world is the
repression of the divine feminine.
Yeah.
Absolutely.
The fact that testosterone exists in an intelligent life form that is evolving past the actual form of that we recognize matter in into a nuclear.
Absolutely.
Yeah.
Well, what else was he then? If people are prophets, if people are prophets of something, he was a prophet of transformation and the use of all technology available for accessing the human biocomputer and coincidence control.
Right.
And so he really believed in a spiritual reality, but it was a completely informed by Eureka and all the rest of the systems that he was familiar with. But I think very legitimate. And one of the most densely detailed descriptions from this trans-dimensional realm that we currently have.
And his incredible invention of the isolation
tank. Oh, my God.
Such a brilliant, brilliant invention.
Yeah.
He was trying to figure out how to separate the mind from the sensory input of the body.
Yes.
And he couldn't get there with meditation, couldn't get there with yoga. He couldn't quite get there. He was always conscious of his body. So he figured out how to do this. And the first sensory deprivation tank was like a scuba tank.
Yeah.
Where you had like a helmet, a scuba helmet, and you would float like from your neck.
They use that in altered states,
describe. Initially, the first, it was pretty chronological in that respect.
Yeah.
They started off with
the vertical one. That's right.
And then went to the horizontal one
once they figured out
how to use salt in it.
Mm-hmm.
But his old ones, he used to have like waste evacuation systems.
Yeah.
Where he would shit and piss in the tank.
For a long time.
Yeah.
You know, the you know, because he was interested in long-term immersion.
Yeah.
And this was basically a replication of something that had been done for many centuries. I'm sure you're familiar with it. You know, the Yongti practice in Tibetan Buddhism is all about the dark retreat. You go into the dark, and you know, all these things that he talks about, that you're still dealing with gravity, blah, blah, blah. But the intention is the same, yes, to remove all distractions and to be surrounded by darkness.
Well, I wouldn't even call it distractions.
And to be awake.
Yeah.
You know, and you lose consciousness of your body so much and are able to access your imagination. Now, Ibn Arabi thought that, and he was a Sufi mystic, my favorite.
Your favorite Sufi mystic?
Absolutely.
You have favorites? What's your top 10?
Well, Rumi would be right next, of course. You know, but Ibn Arabi was the most scholarly, and he called the imagination your angel. That is the place where God meets God.
Hmm.
And so that is the visionary, mystical experience that runs through all world religions, and he details it, and there are celestial hierarchies that Plotinus describes in exactly the same way. They had a cross-cultural, although they were writing it at different times, it wasn't dissemination, it was all direct knowledge. And so these were people that were getting it from the highest command, and it came through their unique lens of their language, and so they each had unique prayers to be in contact with this creative force. And he really did emphasize the sacredness of the divine feminine. And
Lily.
Yes. Yeah. Ibn Arabi.
Ibn Arabi.
And so the great mystics have quite often done the same thing. You know, I mean, what do we have more art of? Goddess sculptures. You know, the goddess is the symbol of beauty, a symbol of love for humanity. And although it gets perverted and things like that, if you step back and just look at the flow of art history, you know, back from the 40,000 years ago to today, what is celebrated? The beauty of the divine feminine and worshipped, really.
Really, truly New Age shamanism, the creation of this sensory deprivation tank, is the creation of something that allows you to take this practice of solitude and darkness to a completely new level and literally remove the body.
Yeah.
Remove the body from the equation. And Lily created...
Well, you're still aware of the smell, and you're still aware... Yeah. But it's much less.
Not really, because all factory senses only detect change. As long as you don't fart in the tank, you're not aware of the smell. Because you won't be aware of anything.
Yeah.
Your nose will stop receiving any changes in input.
I'd love to see the one you've got. Jeez.
Yeah, it was created by this guy, Crash, from the Float Lab. Lab is in Venice, and it's the best place in the country.
Wow.
He's a really mad scientist when it comes to it. There's the filtration systems that he uses are the highest standard, and he's pushing for like an industry standard to try to get people to start taking these things seriously as far as like how you can clean the water to make sure that you could use them commercially.
Yes.
So people have thoughts about that.
Have you been to Munich and to the float experience?
No, I've never been to Munich. Well, maybe I have. Well, I was in Germany. I forget where I was, actually. Sorry. Well,
it was
there for a fight.
What happens is you go into this huge tank. It's like a king-size bed, but bigger, of water.
Okay.
And 8 inches deep, I guess. And so you lay down, and it's the salt, and it's really warm and nice. And it goes down to a very, you know, like ultramarine blue. It doesn't go totally black.
Oh.
And you can close your eyes, and it doesn't change at all, and it's just the most pleasant and amazing relaxation kind of experience. And he's woven it into the German businessman now. On lunch hour, they'll come in and say, "Wow, man, I really need to unwind." And it's just like a half hour later, they're like, "Whoa." It's just like they were meditating.
It does wonders for me, especially after I do jiu-jitsu classes and I'm exhausted and strained out. It lengthens your body. Mm. Like your muscles, they contract and tighten up. And what I mean by lengthen is they relax and sort of extend. They relax and pull away. Everything feels like it sort of just takes a big deep breath, like all of your tissue, like it relieves so much tension. It benefits your body. It's one of the best sources of magnesium, because the magnesium is entering your body through the Epsom salts in your skin. It's actually very healthy for you.
Very interesting. Yeah. Well, you know, the filtration system that they had was unique and patented.
John Lilly's?
No, the one in Germany.
Yeah.
And they saw themselves as continuing to work, you know, John's obvious, you know, invention, and move it forward also in a similar way to your friend is doing out there in Venice.
That sounds like a great idea, though, to have just a really light blue so you can even open your eyes, and just the idea of doing it for as a short-term relaxation thing, that would be very pleasant.
It's extremely uplifting, and probably the color has something to do with it.
Yeah, you know? People love blue. For professional pool, they found out that the color, a light blue, a light calming blue, like a blue sky, is like the best color for seeing objects around it, as far as like seeing edges, the edges of the ball and things like that. The light blue is what really just appeals to the eye. They used to think it was green. Mm-hmm. It was green for the longest time, but now they go with light blue. That feeling
cobalt.
The feeling of floating also in the release of all the input that's coming in from the body allows you to take in information better. And what Crash has been working on over at the Float Lab is what he calls a cellular influence device. And the idea behind it is a screen that fits in front of your visual peripheral, like from here to here. And it is the lowest emission of light that's physically possible. So you literally don't see the edges of the television at all. You see nothing other than whatever is being broadcast. So they figured out how to tune that in. It took him years to figure this out. And he has these speakers that are in the water, literally, on either side of your ear. It's all sealed up, and so they're underwater. And you're in this thing, and first of all, the sound moves the water. It pulsates the water.
Nice.
So you feel the sound. You feel it in your fucking toes. Yeah, you do whatever you want. I mean, what Crash is trying to do is get people to start coding documentaries and instructionals to it, because he thinks it'll speed up learning by a staggering amount.
That's remarkable. It's an immediate kinesthetic kind of taking it on a cellular level, informing your cells all over.
And also the retention is just far stronger and greater because of the fact there's no distractions while it's going on. Same as, I mean, in theory, this all needs to be tested. But I can tell you that as far as just your sheer horsepower for concentration, to me there's never been anything like it in my life, other than psychedelic experiences, but I consider it a very psychedelic experience. Yeah. And, you know,
it probably came to him in that state, and it was used to study that thing. That's how the shamans say, you know, like the plants told us. You know, it was like he was one of the first, really, scientists to do deep studies with LSD.
I find that fascinating, and I find that so hard to believe. I also find it amazing how few scientists today openly discuss psychedelic experiences and are enthusiastic about them.
Well, they'll be ostracized.
Isn't that amazing?
It's sad. It's amazing. It's the same reason that more artists don't talk about it either.
They're not mutually exclusive. You know, that people have to understand that silly behavior, yes, can be attributed to recreational drugs or recreational drug use. But A, that's not what we're talking about.
No.
And B, just because someone is involved in something that other people are using recreational doesn't mean there's not some massive benefit to it that can be discussed by scientists on a really scholarly level. There's something going on
that can truly benefit humanity by harnessing a substance that
may
help people access their expanded states of awareness. Now, that is what Dr. Hoffman wanted, and I quote him at length on his 101st birthday. He wrote the most remarkable thing about the promise of the entheogenic sacraments, and about how he hoped, because he always felt tremendously guilty for anyone who had taken a wrong turn or not been, it had catalyzed their predisposition to a psychotic state. Borderline personalities should avoid it entirely. People who have a history of mental illness, you know, without professional use, they should avoid these things for sure. But sometimes people take them. And so it haunted him horribly. And he was never an advocate, but he, at the end of his life, really, you know, he kind of told people about it. He on stage would say that, you know, I synthesized it in 1938. We tested it on animals. Nothing happened, you know. And then 5 years later, you know, in April, he starts to hear a voice that asks him to resynthesize this particular molecule. Now, he synthesizes thousands and thousands of molecules, but he said never before had he heard that voice calling him to do a particular thing. So he did it. And April 19th, when he finally basically dosed himself in 1943, at 4:20.
Really?
Yeah. A 4:19 at 4:20.
P.M.
P.M. He, in his journal, he writes, that was his, that's when he took it. And
is that the origin of 4:20?
No. No, it's not.
Can't be, because that wouldn't make sense.
No, it isn't. But it's an interesting coincidence.
Yeah.
And so, I mean, it may have had some sequential elegance in his own journal writing. It wasn't randomly that he chose that time to do it, because it was an experiment that he was wondering about. But he brewed up the tiniest amount that any you know, that is for sure not active by any substance known to humanity. If you take 250 millionths of a gram, nothing happens with anything. That's like, what do they call it? Homeopathy. You know, it's that kind of dosage. But little did he know that he had stumbled upon the most potent psychoactive substance of all times. You know, it's, you know, many times more potent and powerful than any other sacrament in those tiny amounts. And so, he was catapulted into a kind of chaos that he thought he was dying, of course, you know. And he just didn't want to die in the lab. He wanted to just go home, you know, to die. And so he was freaking out, feeling for sure he had poisoned himself. And he and his assistant rode their bicycles back. And, of course, that's why they call it Bicycle Day, you know, 4:19. And that he made it home. And then they called.
It was April 19th?
April 19th.
It was April
1943.
At 4:20.
Yes. Yes. That there was a. I did a painting that's in the Net of Being book.
We need to bet the lottery. We need to call. We need to put some numbers down.
Well, you know what happened that same day?
What?
Probably around the same time.
What?
Well, there was a Warsaw ghetto uprising that happened in the wake of the Nazis wanting to burn down the Warsaw ghetto. And it never happened before. There was a spike in the novelty curve that day that was off the charts. And it led to a siege. It never happened, and never happened since.
Whoa. What the fuck's up with that number?
Isn't that interesting? Isn't that interesting?
Does that make sense?
It's a synchronicity that's just interesting. You know, something I've been noticing, and I can't explain it at all, but it's just one of those mystery things, like you were saying, like in your dream you see these various things, you know they're saying something. It's almost like God is a punster, you know, and putting visual rebuses, this is a visual language, you know, in front of us.
Have you ever looked into all this stuff that's going on right now in physics, where all these different scientists are proposing the idea that we're living inside of a simulation? And it's becoming more and more prominent today. I got a new thing, technologyreview.com, a new thing published by MIT. And this was sent to me through Twitter. So, of course, I had to investigate it because I'm inundated by this shit. Like, yeah, literally every day there's like some new study or some new proposal about the world being some sort of the universe, the reality being some sort of a simulation. When you see shit like the number 420 coming up over and over again, 419 mm-hmm. and 420, do you ever stop and go, well, maybe that's just the way it was written?
It's the cosmic code. It's the cosmic wink. You know, there are so many correspondences, I feel, like the, look at what happened to psychedelic culture. After that time, there came a time of tremendous repression. But first, there was scientific study. So they actually established the true merits of these substances prior to them becoming illegal. Illegal for political reasons, by the way, you know. And I think it's anti-American because America is all about freedom of religion and freedom of point of view. And as Terence McKenna says, you know, there's nothing ever been adduced against them except that they give people funny ideas.
Yeah. Well, your definition of America, much like your definition of God, is not the popular one. You know, as far as the rest of the world, when they think of what America represents, they think of a giant military monster.
Exactly. Yeah. It's AmeriCorps. That's what I call it. AmeriCorps is that what America has become.
Right.
It's a living death that's being perpetrated on the world. And it's because of this, sellout. You know, of the soul to the military-industrial complex. Eisenhower warned us about it.
I was just going to say that, yeah.
And so, you know, there are various reformers in government that are trying, you know, really trying to shift things. But they're massive forces, you know, the archons, as the Gnostics would say, you know, that are kind of dragging their heels in the evolutionary bell curve. They haven't gotten the message that we're all a unity and that we need to now think about how we can best preserve the life web, not how we can destroy it and make profits for a few years while we watch the weather go haywire.
There's never before been a clear indication that the people who are in charge are not... They're not tuned into the internet. They came about this way. They created this way long before there was an internet. And this is how it's always been done. And now that it's being exposed all around them, they're still clinging to this archaic notion of non-connection.
Right.
This archaic notion that all of your actions, all of your deeds, and all of our thoughts and feelings aren't all connected in some sort of a strange way that we need to recognize, address, and... We need to move forward with that as an ideal, that we are all connected. And,
you know, yes, absolutely. We not have to recover it. We have to recover it. It's
big
essential.
Big foreign banks. It's not happening with the Federal Reserve or whoever the fuck is in charge of sending us to Afghanistan or whoever wants us to put, you know.
Yeah. Well, that was an obvious and huge mistake. There's even a page in there called Remembering 9/11 Before It Happened. You know, now I think that it's pretty remarkable kind of thing that happened there. Of course, who but a spook would do something like that? 9/11. That's a joke. Okay, emergency. You know, that's a spook. That's a joke.
What do you mean? What do you mean?
Like the 9/11 is the code word for emergency.
Right, right.
Now, outside of America, ? You know, like, that's a reference that only an American would play with. Mm-hmm. Because, so then we have all the explosive evidence about what happened that day. Now, the burning of the Reichstag and all that, have we forgotten history? You know, it's a massive distraction to, stop everybody from paying attention to Enron and go into some place that never attacked us.
This is your point
of view. The Iraq War. What was that based on? But a lot of lies. And Afghanistan the same way, that there was a need to sell weaponry and to spend money on these, these mercenaries in order to satisfy a certain hunger. And this hunger is the shadow, is the Setian energy that dwells in the desert and is and we are living off of. What we need to become is a solar-powered humanity. We are still struggling with Set and Horus, who fought an epic battle thousands of years ago in the deserts of Egypt and continue it today. The soul of humanity has to go toward the light and find new energy means to bring us out of our dependence, our addictions to the destructive web of this kind of oligarchy that we're enmeshed in.
So it's your opinion that September 11th was some sort of a false flag event, and it wasn't just incompetence or an attack that was capitalized on by people with nefarious ideas, that it was instead planned?
I entertain that possibility, and I think that the entire affair needs to be examined. But why I was setting that up and the controversial elements that many scientists bring up, not, you know, like artists, you know,
you mean like but architects people, and engineers,
yes, all those people who analyze the actual material and the pulling of Building 7 as the smoking gun. But, you know, you can go down that and look at it. I think it should be examined. But the what I find fascinating about the entire thing is the nest of synchronicities that artists were exhibiting on that day. There was a man who had a studio, an artist who had a studio in Tower 1. A number of artists had studios, actually, in the Twin Towers. And his name was Michael Richards, actually. He was a black artist, and he was a sculptor, and remarkable, wonderful work.
Did he hate himself?
Well, he was an awesome.
That was a bad joke.
Yeah, yeah. No, he has no relationship to that fella, right. And just happened to have the same name. And so his entire body of work was destroyed practically when the plane hit the Twin Towers. And so a couple months later, some of his friends discover in this museum in South Carolina that they have one of his pieces once been discovered. And it was a self-portrait. As Saint Sebastian, you know, but instead of arrows going through the body, they were airplanes.
Wow.
Okay.
Whoa.
Saint Sebastian and the Tar Baby is what it's called.
Wow.
Now, that is a fact. Now, I did a painting like in 1989. It was a vision I had the day our daughter was born, and it became the painting Gaia. Now, what's interesting, you can look in that book, Net of Being. We were in the World Trade Center September 10th, whoa, 2001.
Wow.
And I put my tag in there, actually. And in the Gaia painting, there happened to be two airplanes. And there's also the Twin Towers. There's someone who looks strangely like George Bush. He's embracing a terrorist and a diseased dick. And I had no idea. It was used in the Beastie Boys' Ill Communication album, which, by the way, has I can't stand it. The most famous hit from that album was Sabotage. I tell you now, y'all, it was Sabotage.
Right.
You know, and so there are numerous things planted into the collective consciousness, you could say. But then the comic book of Superman that came out September 12th, actually, had the Twin Towers surrounded in smoke. and helicopters were around them. The first panel, panel one, there was a hip-hop group. Everybody remembers this thing. It was released that week after 9/11. There was this hip-hop group, The Coup, who had two members there, and they were with kind of like plungers, and in back of them, the Twin Towers exploding. Now, they were prevented from releasing it because it was September 12th. They said, oh, whoa, 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 no, 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 no. But September 11th in Boston was released live from New York, this particular place, this band in Boston, and it had the Twin Towers surrounded in flame.
So you think that these people who are creating this art, that are envisioning these images, that they're pulling this from some
the
sort
collective
of,
from the collective. I mean, Close Encounters, right? Remember that moment when they all go into the artist's room where they're, oh, this one drew it and that one sculpted it and that one, you know, like they all got blazed with something and it's such a fascinating nest of synchronicities that I believe it's unprecedented.
Well, your point of view on just reality itself has got to be so much different than the average person's. How often do you bring up this? I mean, this is a very controversial and strange thing to say. You know, I mean, it's a very it's requires.
I'm not saying that it that you know that my painting or various other things necessarily lead to the truth, but they point toward something strange, very strange. I mean, anybody examining the evidence, it wasn't premeditated. Mm-hmm. It's remembering 9/11 before it happened.
Right. What I was saying was, this is the way, I mean, you have to sort of lay this out. How many times have you had this conversation with someone and you could see them go, okay. Look at the time.
Show the evidence, though. Uh-huh. Show Michael Richards' sculpture, which we do in this book, Net of Being. The folks at DC weren't fond of it, so I didn't reproduce their thing. But people can go onto the internet and find it.
The folks at DC? What is that?
DC Comics. Oh. They didn't want the Superman panel reproduced in a thing like that. But you can talk about it, and you can say exactly what happened. And just to pointing it out, you have a sense of the uncanny. There's a coup, see? Right? They couldn't release that thing.
Well, that's the real image?
Yeah, that's it. No, that's not the real image. That was what they fabricated and were to release that week. But were prevented by every good sense, you know, to say, good grief, we cannot be doing this.
I didn't
this
mean, is that the real image of 9/11? Yeah, I meant, is that the real image from their CD cover?
Yeah, that was incredible. A CD cover.
That was incredible.
Yeah, so, I mean, this is a smoking gun of some kind of revelatory breakthrough that was a terrible thing. It was a terrible thing, but it leaked through the consciousness of humanity. So you see the power of art as prophecy, mm-hmm. and you see the power of art as what could it point us toward? We want to see a sacred possibility. We want to look at our highest potential, not look at the destructive. We want to take that power of art and plant seeds of liberation in the minds of people, not in this kind of negative world of self-destructive nihilist culture and behavior.
My point of view, or what I was trying to get at, was when you go into this sort of a definition of things, it's a very fantastical and amazing sort of a concept that there is some sort of a frequency that we're tuning into, and we're getting warnings from you know, future events that will have a big ripple in time. How is this normally received when you talk to people? I mean, you're a very unusual guy. How many people can you talk to about this stuff?
I think it's unsettling to most people because I haven't heard it spoken of, but I just happened to be one of the people that got blazed with a vision. I had forgotten about it entirely. I knew I'd painted some, oh, this is the dark possibility of humanity, and this is the light, this is the nature, you know, and this is what we have to, and here's Al Gore with some basket of fruits and things.
What is the name of that? Gaia. Can you pull that up? Gaia. Can you pull that up?
A Gaia painting. And
how long did you do this before September 11th?
It was 1989. It was, I had the vision in 1988, the day our daughter was born. You know how powerful, you know, your child being born is. It impacts you. So we had been up for 3 days anyway, and I had to leave my wife. They kind of kicked me out, and I had to go do an illustration project. But as I was going over the Brooklyn Bridge, I had this vision. You know, and this—it was probably the division, you know, Manhattan and Brooklyn or something, you know. But I had this this diptych kind of thing. There's a better one on alexgray.com, but the that's basically it. The World Tree as the Great Mother, and the stress that humanity is causing.
Dude, the Twin Towers and the planes—that's fucking trippy.
Yeah, so 1989, and there was somebody who bought it, and of course it was in the Ill Communication album, and then I published it in 1990 in the Sacred Mirrors book, my first book that came out then, and so that was in there, and after 9/11, some people sent me emails and showed me the picture again, and I hadn't remembered any of that at all.
That's amazing. That's really, really freaky. When you think about these ideas and these blips and these signals and whatever it is that you tune into when you become creative, you know, when you think about the impact that the work that comes out of it has on people, what do you think ultimately we're doing here as humans?
We're evolving our consciousness.
Are we in a transformative process?
Absolutely. Yeah. You can't help but be transformative.
Does technology and destruction have anything to do with that?
Of course. It's accelerating the shadow.
The need for change, too.
The need for change.
The need to grow. It's absolutely. Almost like we're threatening suicide unless we do something about it.
Absolutely.
Get your shit together, I'm going to blow my brains out.
Yes. The waking up is happening a lot through the interconnectedness of the web of technology. Technology had to happen after an industrial period. All of it has been an evolving intelligence that is finally beginning to see its cosmic origins in the story of the universe that we've been discovering, and the Hubble telescope that shows us the vastness of space and the understanding of dark energy now that connects everything, the clusters of galaxies that had to exist. The Earth is a rare kind of, I think of it as the as this alchemical
balancing act.
Well, it's you know, the alembic that goes around the sort of whatever the alchemist puts into his retort or into his flask. This flask then is heated, and it has a special temperature that brings the interior to transformation, and it goes through a lot of different stages. But I think of the Earth and its surrounding geomagnetic field. The geomagnetic field is our alembic. It's our alchemical alembic. Now you look at the Mars, and it no longer has a magnetic field around it. And so everything has died. And so this magnetic field that surrounds the Earth is our protection from the solar flares and the solar heat of the sun, and gives that beautiful kind of aurora that happens. And so just at this particular orbit where we in relationship with our guru, the sun, and we have this attraction, you know, but what is attraction? It's the bending of space-time, and you're at a particular circulation, but that circulation has the alembic of the geomagnetic field around it, thus what the experiment of life can unfold. It takes billions and billions of years to grow an intelligence that can start to recognize its own source. That's astonishing. That's a great epic journey of the evolution of human consciousness, and that's what's really going on. don't read the times, read the eternities, as Emerson said, you know.
It's a great quote.
Did you ever see the Dream Theater album cover, live scenes from New York City?
Check yeah, it there out. It is.
Yeah.
There it is, in flames. Released 9/11.
Yeah. It has the Twin Towers on fire on an apple.
That's crazy.
Yeah.
The future. How do you think this is all going to play out? I mean, obviously you believe that you expressing yourself with love and using art and finding creativity elevates the human experience, as do I. I think there's something yeah. incredible about seeing great art in any form, whether it's great music, great paintings, whatever it is, or something about seeing someone really tap into whatever it is that is going on when you're being creative, whatever it is that you're when you're really accessing the imagination,
yes.
that elevates us. It
absolutely.
You see that as an integral part of this experience, of this transformative experience that human beings are going through. But where do you see it going? Like, what do you see?
Awakening to our own creative spirit, our own unique lens into the infinite one that we all are and reflections of. You know, ultimately, humanity has a great future. If you look at the evolutionary bell curve of what's possible for human consciousness and love, how primitive it still seems that humanity is in terms of their ability to love one another. You know, we've had great teachers from all over the world, you know, teach us the same thing. The wisdom masters say repeatedly to love each other, you know, and not to kill each other. And it's something that is so simple and so true and so beautiful. And this is the affirmation of the intelligence that built our cells. We have to tap into the, you know, we recently had the guest Paul Stamets, visit COSM a couple weeks ago at our
for folks who don't
summer.
Know COSM, what you're referring to is the Chapel of Sacred Mirrors in New York.
Absolutely. At the Chapel of Sacred Mirrors in Wappinger, actually, we had the great eco-mycologist Paul Stamets, who's written extensively about the power of fungus, and the he's one of the world's experts in medicinal and just the power of these things to, like, he uses them to soak up oil spills. The oyster mushrooms and things like that have been used to draw hydrocarbons out of water that's been polluted with them. In Chernobyl, in the 30-mile radius around Chernobyl, there are funguses growing, mushrooms growing that are hot. They're radiation filled because the mycelium that they fruit from has been drawing all of the radiation from the soil in order for life to come back to the forest. They're the deepest, oldest plant on Earth, and human beings themselves diverged from the fungus over 650 million years ago. So we have this connection, this web of connectedness, and obviously a connection with the intelligence of the mushroom. And Paul, far from being a Terence sort of endorsing of the you know, exogenous kind of fertilization of the earth with the spore, he believes it was homegrown, and he believes that we're exporting. So I love that kind of can-do, earth-based consciousness that evolved in this alembic.
And for those who don't understand what you meant by that, what you meant for the story is that McKenna believes that it's possible that mushrooms came from the vacuum of space.
Yes,
they arrived here possible. On asteroids. The theory of panspermia,
yeah.
which is, we know amino acids and certain things are transferred, and there are asteroids here from other planets that have landed meteorites.
Yeah,
and that is also one of the theories about what happened to Mars as well, right? And that's how yes. they lost their environment. It was an asteroidal impact.
Possible. And certainly we, the human, or the great chain of being and great chain of evolution that was impacted on the Earth, certainly there's a belief that they meteorite, you know, basically ended the era of the dinosaurs and these little rat-like things that were our ancestors were able to become more dominant as a species and evolve due to the territorial kind of disputes being over with these large lizard people.
Yeah, that really was a nice break for us.
Really, and it had to happen. But, you know, we have Big Brother Jupiter out there watching our back and is taking the heat. You know, he's the bouncer of the whole cosmos or our little solar system. And so only at a certain level, surrounded by a living kind of alembic and shielded by a particular kind of planetary brother, was life of this kind even possible? Think of how many billions of galaxies it might take. We certainly are probably the only, you know, Earth planetary consciousness in the universe, obviously. You know, we're a unique little neighborhood.
But when you say Earth planetary consciousness in the universe, what do you mean by that exactly?
Well, there's no other Earth.
Right.
We're it. We're the Earth.
We're this planet.
Yeah.
We're the only ones.
We're the only ones. Right. It evolves uniquely. Darwin showed that. Mm-hmm. On every little cove or things evolve a little bit differently. So wherever else life exists, if it does, and it quite likely does, most scientists would agree that, but we have a unique jewel. We've been gifted with it from billions of years of evolution. Don't fucking blow it. That's the most important thing.
Yeah, it's what you're saying, if people don't understand it, is that Jupiter has a massive amount of gravity. It's enormous, and it absorbs asteroidal impacts. It sucks them all up. It's like the bodyguard for the Earth.
It's amazing.
Yeah.
Yeah.
Yeah, it's truly a unique situation as far as what we've studied in the cosmos. But it might be further evidence that there's a simulation. It might be.
Yeah, which is awesome. Well, you know, my experience with Allison, just to inform that one, our first kind of breakthrough psychedelic experience that changed both of our works, it happened about a year after we first met, like our first anniversary, June 3rd, say, 1976. And we both melted down into these kind of toroidal fountains and drains of light. And every other being and thing in the universe was one of these balls of light. It's like a soul. But it was, you know, like an amazing kind of torus. It was like a toroidal flow. And this thing felt much more alive and real than our kind of material world reality. It felt like this is what's really going on. It's eternally and infinitely light, and we are projecting our kind of souls into experiences to have enriching educational opportunities and try to wake up. God sent us here to wake up to God, you know, to the core of our being, to our God self. That's why this painting that's on the cover of The Net of Being is called God Self, because it's a symbol of our interconnectedness with all other God selves. It's every other being and thing in the network has access to this great, vast intelligence of the cosmos. There's no other reason that we could be here.
When you believe that and think that, and then see what's going on, like with everybody saber-rattling about going to war with Iran, well, how does that make you feel?
I feel very sad, you know, because really it's about break out the peace, monkeys. You know, don't destroy each other. And don't poison the web that sustains you. That is only logical. And by toxifying both the consciousness of humanity, by, you know, entraining people's minds with limiting self-images, instead of accessing our unity as a human species and expand beyond that, if you can feel, even though you may hate your neighbor, you know, you may have a gripe here or there, But ultimately, you connected with loved ones. Love brought us all here. Love is the highest expression of the cosmos. You know, Albert Hoffman said that the highest refinement of light in the universe is love. Because it took a solar battery like our sun to give birth to a planet Earth, and it took the evolutionary train billions of years to get here to a point where a consciousness, a brain, was capable of having the experience of love, which was the common source of everyone, the love that brought us all here, to recognize it in each other, to honor it in each other through all different ways, and to celebrate that amazing experience, and to try and, you know, turn the ship around now, folks. You know, don't go over the edge. Don't commit suicide. Do something harder. You know, why is it more impossible, as the Occupy folks said, to imagine the end of capitalism than, why is it more easy to imagine the apocalypse than the end of capitalism?
You think that capitalism is the big problem, and it's not just putting money above morals?
It's part of it, yes. All of that, because it's not a God-centered consciousness. We've wandered away. You know,
is it possible, though, to have a God-centered consciousness and produce all the shit that we produce, to make all the laptops we make, to make all the cars we make?
You know what Steven Jobs was into, my friend.
Yeah, yeah. He was into yelling at his employees.
Yes.
He was into making Chinese people work for $50 a month. He was into a lot of shit.
Yeah, there was, but look at the nucleus of where those things that you were just celebrating came from.
Well, he made a beautiful company.
It was from his LSD experiences. Mm-hmm. He credited that with being a tremendous opening for him, and informing his breakthroughs in technology. And Carrie Mullis, the Nobel Prize winning molecular biologist, has said exactly the same thing. And many people's lives have been ruined by these things, but many other people's lives have been saved, my own.
The Francis Crick story, is that true?
There you go, yes.
Is that true?
Well, you know, it is a
conjecture. Me.
It is a. It was released after his death,
right?
Because he, by threat of death, said such and so. Now you could say,
yeah.
"Oh, now somebody's just trying to hijack that breakthrough of the imagination." But then you go back to when it happened, and you realize that actually he was a psychedelic advocate, and he had, like many of his scientist friends, experimented with these substances which were supposed to catalyze the creative imagination. So he had read the papers, and he had access to these things. And there was no stigma about it. Mm-hmm. In fact, the first Life magazine stuff about psychedelics was extremely positive.
And if there was no stigma about it, then why didn't he come out and say it initially?
Oh, because by the time that it was a... You would think. But he might not want to sully his breakthrough
by
putting anything between the breakthrough insight and the, you know, then what are you talking about? What? You know, based on a drug-induced hallucination?
Yeah.
But, you know, I mean, that's how the benzene ring was discovered. It was in a dream, you know, and so great discoveries come through the visionary imagination.
Isn't that how Descartes got the idea of science in the first place?
There you go.
It was a dream that I think the exact quote was that science and nature would be conquered by using measurement.
There you go. Well, that was a really important thing, but conquered gives it.
Yeah, I think I probably use
the
word.
But that is an aggressive stance.
Overcome,
the male species has promoted because it's very self-serving, and I think that if you know part of what we're doing at this point and as evolving human beings is trying to create a new model of possibility for humanity in a realm of sometimes for some people diminishing expectations. So the Paul Stamets point of view of how mushrooms can save the world and how mycelium is actually a network of intelligence that connects us with the plant realm and that we can take advantage of by tapping into the nervous system that's humanity diverged from over 650 million years ago. Now, that's tapping into cosmic intelligence.
Do you follow McKenna's stoned ape theory? Do
yeah.
you feel like that's
yeah.
the way
a lot of people and even responsible anthropologists think that there's something to it? Because they certainly would have encountered the psilocybin mushrooms. And who can say that it didn't play a part in catalyzing the growth of human consciousness? Now, it was Leary's, or I mean, Lilly, well, both Leary and Lilly's ideas. Was that it? That these substances could advance in the evolution of human consciousness. Now you look at the Unio de Vegetal, which is the first psychedelic church for white people, I guess, in the United States. And part of the mission of the UDV, which is a church that originated in Brazil, you know, the heart of the Amazon, from the green mantle of the earth. The green emerald comes these great wisdom traditions that are spreading throughout the world with ayahuasca. And people are waking up to the mind of nature through these plant sacraments that have been used for centuries, for, you know, thousands of years, actually. And more and more anthropologists are saying, well, they were seeing visions in the place. We know that the bog people used to smoke cannabis. And cannabis has been humanity's friend for a long time. Now, a neuroscientist, just to, and I'll hand the floor over, a neuroscientist quoted in Scientific American said most neuroscientists would agree that everything that we experience is a figment of our imagination.
Most neuroscientists would agree this?
That's what she said.
She might be crazy.
She might be, but she had an entire issue of Scientific American Optical Illusions that it's a yearly publication. And so she argues for this idea of the plasticity of the mind. And when you take these dimensional shifts, you know, like you're changing the radio station with your kind of dimensional shifting that some psychonauts are able to do, you're tapping into different wavelengths.
So you literally change reality.
Absolutely.
You literally can change reality. Reality is
Reality is co-dimensional.
Malleable.
Reality is co-dimensional. It's not like this conversation changes reality in this dimension, but it also has resonance with another dimension.
So it's essentially what we were talking about earlier. It's neither real nor not real, and that
exactly. There you go.
It's a combination of. Yeah. Imagination and reality. One of the things that always struck me about imagination is how it's sort of marginalized. Like the idea of, oh, that Timmy, he's got a vivid imagination.
Right.
You know, there's something to that. But the reality is that every physical thing, including this building that we're in, including this chair that you're sitting in, the microphone that you're talking through, all of it was created through the imagination. So it did not exist. It was thought up. Through the imagination, then became it manifested itself in a physical form,
and we've become basically numb to the spectacle
of
the creation that has unfolded before us. And if we could remove our blinders and notice the awesomeness, you know, and lean away from the jibber jabber, you know, we could be more at peace and maybe recognize that the same beautiful. True and good stuff that flows through your heart is flowing through mine.
Well, if it is possible, I believe that conversations like this are what move the consciousness of the people who listen to this and the people who consider these thoughts and the things that you've said. It does move things in a better direction. It moves it in the better direction for those people that are listening. And I think if there's any one way we really can change this world, it's to change the way people who are open-minded view it. If you're open and you introduce a positive new idea into someone's mind, you know, that can change them and benefit them in a positive way. So if you really wanted to change the world, you already just did it. You just did it with this conversation.
You're awesome, Joe.
And you're awesome too, man. I love you too, man. Your work is amazing. And for folks who want to stay up on everything you're doing, they could follow you on Twitter. It's Alex Gray Cosm, C-O-S-M, Gray, E-Y, not A-Y. What is your website?
Well, the most important thing that's going on is really the Chapel of Sacred Mirrors project. Okay. We're creating our first sacred structure, our temple. We're building it there, and it is an incredibly important time for us. If you look at alexgray.com, Entheon is really the thing that we're working on now, and that is this new sanctuary for visionary art. And it is multi-denominational or trans-denominational acknowledgement of the power of the creative spirit, and it's occurring in architecture now. And it's a place to house this thing. It's something Allison and I were shown in a dream, and she's the co-founder of the Chapel of Sacred Mirrors. She inspired the Sacred Mirrors series. She named the Sacred Mirrors. So the honoring of the divine feminine is really at the center of my life, and she turned my life around with her love. And so that kind of love is, and the creative evolutionary spirit that goes through everybody is kind of what we celebrate at Cosm. And so people do a lot of creative, there's art church. We just had an awesome art church with other visionary artists. It's happening around the world. Visionary artists are like providing cultural alternatives, you know, where like-minded people, we call them the love tribe, because you find them all over the world, you know, who've awakened to something beyond, you know, the stressful, politically charged national boundaries, and they're global citizens. They are tapped into the world-centric intelligence that could help lead us, you know, to a planetary civilization.
And they, by the way, probably didn't exist 50 years ago.
Yeah, exactly.
Yeah, so that's the big jump. Yeah. That's one of the things when people want to talk about how bad everything is, they're not aware of how good it is, too.
Yeah.
So Chapel of Sacred Mirrors, is it Chapel? What is the website?
Cosm. Cosm. Cosm.org.
Cosm.org.
And alexgray.com has just been revised by our dear friends Fong and Scotty.
Beautiful.
And there will be updates about Entheon, and it's an incredibly important step for our community and for visionary art, we hope.
Listen, man, you just rocked a lot of people's worlds today. you threw a monkey wrench into the gears of reality for a lot of folks. I think that was awesome. Thank you very much
Thank
for
you.
Doing this. Anytime
Thank
you want to do it again, I would love to. It was just
love
too much
job.
Fun.
All right.
Thank you, brother.
Take
thanks to Audible.com for sponsoring this podcast. And again, if you go to audible.com/Joe, you can try Audible for free for 30 days and get a free audiobook. And as Brian has said, and I've said, the Steve Martin one on doing stand-up. What is it called, stand-up?
Born Standing Up.
Standing Up. Yeah. It's fucking amazing, man. It's read by Steve Martin. If I wanted to just introduce you to something that would get you to really appreciate the impact of audiobooks, that's my personal idea. That's Brian's as well. It's a great choice. Give it a shot, but there's a million books on there. I mean, I don't know how many there are, but it's an incredible amount of interesting books on CD or on audio, rather, an MP3 form that you can listen to pretty much anywhere. And it just makes commutes and it makes otherwise meaningless time. It makes it educational and inspirational. And it's an awesome website, audible.com/Joe. Go there, get your free 30 days of audio books. You son of a bitch. All right. We're also brought to you by Ting. And Ting is the mobile company that we've started working with. No contracts. The way it works is if you don't use all your minutes, you're actually credited for the next month. They drop your bill down and you're credited. It's a beautiful company. And they use the Sprint backbone. So it's excellent service. It's a great line of phones that they use, mostly Android phones, but they also have some right if you're one of those old school dudes resisting change and you're into flip phones, they even have those things. So go and check that out, you freaks. And also, thanks to Onnit.com for sponsoring our podcast. Go to O-N-N-I-T. I checked. I can't find the blenders online, so I guess they're not there yet. But just to let you know, the blenders are on the way, you dirty bitches. And kettlebells are there. We have an awesome supply of kettlebells in various various weights and sizes. We also have packages and we have the battle ropes in as well, which there's videos explain how to use them and what to do with them. It's an awesome way to work out your entire body. If you use the code name Rogan, you will save 10% off any and all the supplements. You can't use that with kettlebells and battle ropes, though, because shit's expensive to send through the mail, yo. We're sending you giant chunks of the earth, giant metal with handles. But it's manly as fuck and really good for your body. So go check it out. Desquad.tv, you're out of shirts, right?
Nope, all in stock.
Oh, bitches, they're back. So any of the psychotic kitty cat shirts that Brian has produced, they are original Brian Redband works of art as well, by the way, ladies and gentlemen. You can get them at Desquad.tv and also be informed as to when tickets are available for shows that Brian may be doing with other folks that are involved in what is called the Desquad. Including the End of the World show with Honey Honey, Joey Diaz, Doug Stanhope, and myself at the Wiltern, December 21st, 2012. The tickets are available right now. No, there's not going to be any End of the World, folks. Okay, everything's going to be beautiful. And if you go to twitter.com/Joe Rogan and search through my timeline, you can see that there's pre-sale for today and tomorrow, and the password is tickets. All right, you freaks, that's it for this week, because I gotta go to Brazil and I won't be back until next week. But next week we got 5 podcasts and it's gonna be fucking awesome, so we'll see you then. Thank you, Alex Gray.
Thank you, Joe Rogan.
It's beautiful.